I made a diagram last summer of the trigonometric functions, and I thought I would complete it for you, and I've been trying to get it run to your head because I'm a little slow at looking at my paper and putting it on the board. But when I finish it, I think it's going to be useful to you. But remember then that we're always starting with the universe, and then we're subdividing. So we start with a sphere. Our geometry begins with a sphere, or at least with a system. And a sphere is simply a high frequency on the structural system. The sphere is a high frequency structural system. All triangulated, and so it'd be approximately unit radius, high frequency structural system. And I'm going to go through some of the arguments of the geometers of the early days about how you play a game of geometry in Egypt and Greece, which is really worth our feeling here, because they took for granted a flat earth, so they started on a plane. But if I'm going to play the game in starting with the totality, I've got to say, what do I have to prove things so well? I think you're going to find it comes out really very satisfactory. So I'll complete my picture here. This is then a section through our sphere, radius, and we have we just make a working assumption. Radius is one. It is subfrequency. It's just unity. Radius unity. And I have the angle that is considered is called theta. And it's from here to here. And this is half theta. It's a is half theta. And it gives when it's, you have the right to have a perpendicular bisector of the chord, so we can assume this 90 degree angle, so it's the right angle that out of which we then come into trigonometric functioning. I've spoken public for years and years and years. I've never had drunk water at speaking until I came here, and always because I was a long distance runner, and I found that nature makes her own juices and has her second winds and things, and I know that you don't drink water when you're running, and you don't drink water when you let nature do that, so that I'm a little puzzled by, I think this is a tail end of a cold. I had a very bad cold in December and came back from Europe to speak here in Philadelphia, and I literally couldn't speak for the first time that ever happened to me. And so there's some kind of tail end of something going on there. I don't know what to say. I'm sorry about it. Now, coming back to our diagram, I want to complete it. It just takes me a little bit to do so. I want to make a green line here. And I want to have so many things to keep in your fingers. And an orange line here, vertically. And I have a red line line. E up here. And I'm going to make a diagram of that here. I just started making a side picture what's in the diagram on the side. That seemed to be useful. Now, what message is missing here? There's an M missing here. No, it's an M. Hope that's as clear as goes there. Now, I think everything is on here. And so we're talking about a trigonometric angle. This is angle theta. And so she's always isosceles, and then to get the advantage of the right triangle and all the laws of right triangles, we then have this perpendicular to the chord, and we get the half theta, which is A. And that's the angle we always do our checking. This is what we're checking up on all the time. And so I'm now going to mark what these are. This orange one over here is FD. F. And goes down to D here. So FD is cotangent. It actually says all these things right on the diagram, but I sort of separate them out too. F and O, O is center of the sphere, and it's F and O, and it is your cosecant. And the red one here has the E and O for me here. This is your secant. And then E to B is tangent. And M to K is the famous sign, S-I-N-E. And this is your cosine. Those two sides of the right triangle, the sine and cosine. And so they are of this famous angle theta, half theta A, when we look at. I think this makes things look fairly simple for you, and looking up, you know what you're really finding out. The data you'll get will be either expressed in degrees, minutes. It could be sometimes they do it in hundredths of a degree, and that you can be done in radians and so forth. But it does make a difference which language you use. You're multiplying and dividing. So your formulas will be multiplying and dividing one of these things times another all the way through to find out various trigonometric phenomena. I think this is quite a simple diagram, and it was not given to me when I was young, so that I really worked on it in the summer to really have it. It seemed to me pretty easy. Now, I like to think about the game of geometry as played by the Greeks and the Egyptians. They played their game with a straight edge, dividers, so so your dividers, you can strike circles, or you can measure distances. And straight edge dividers. And you had to demonstrate that an unfamiliar geometrical form consists of demonstrated forms in terms of your original constructs. But whereas they played a game of making, using a straight edge, then taking any point on the line, put the dividers on there, and they can strike a circle. and it'll cross the straight line of two points, and those will be the radii, and you know they're equal to one another, and they're half in diameter. This is a fairly simple game. Take it then from the where the circle crossed the straight line, they could go out there with the dividers to the end, put the dividers on the crossing point, and strike, break into the circle from either end. And they never could prove that the space between was the same, was the radius. Therefore, they never assumed the equilateral triangle. Starting from a plane, you get into that trouble. And I don't get in that trouble. I'm sure there's one reason why the 60-degreeness has not gone into the popular game of geometry. The radial seems to be self-evident, but that's all. And you knew that the dividers seemed to span exactly, but you couldn't prove it. So I'm now going to start, and I'm going to say I'm working on a plane. I'm going to make a sphere. I have my dividers, I have a point in the universe, and I have a radius going in all directions. Okay? So I've now got a surface to work on, and I know all of that surface is equidistant from a given point. Now I'm going to take any point on the surface of the sphere, and I'm going to strike a circle on the surface of the sphere. You and I call it a lesser circle. But we know that every point in that circle is equidistant from that point on the sphere, on the outside sphere. We also know that every point on that circle is equidistant from the center of the sphere. That's quite nice. So now we have two kinds of things. We have a radius of the sphere that is known, and we have the radius of the surface circle that is known. They're both the same divided. I can now then take any point on the surface circle and dividers and strike another point on that same circle. You see that? Now, I'm going to go to more or less the opposite side of the circle. Don't make any difference where I come on there. Some other part of the lesser circle. I find quite quickly with my dividers that the lesser circle really seems to consist of quite a number of increments of this. So I'm going to go any opposite side where, doesn't make a difference, and just take another point on the lesser circle on the surface, put my dividers on that, and strike against the lesser circle again. I got two increments. They are. Just look at the globe of the world, and I got a circle up here, but this one here, let's say, is about the same as radius of it, and I come to an arbitrary point out here, and I strike on the circle here. I now know what that distance is. Quite clearly, if I try stepping my dividers around, it takes quite a few divisions, so all I have to do is go the opposite side to pick any point I want somewhere in here. Dividers and strike another. And I've got two arc sections of that lesser circle that I know are radius. I have a unit radius, a distance now, which is the original radius of a sphere and the radius of the circle on the surface. I've got two increments here which are exactly the same. I'm now going to run a line back to the center surface point here and two lines from there. This now gives me two triangles on the surface with that I know the radii of those, the edges of those triangles are all equilateral. I know I've got two equilateral triangles with a common apex at this center of the surface circle, which goes down to the center of the sphere. And we know they're all equidistant. So So then I was able to take those. That's I. You may remember the way I made the four great circles. Yes, it kind of looks kind of familiar because. I want you to look, for instance, here is the sphere, fine. I got on the opposite point here up here and I struck a circle. Now I've got these two units here, and all I've got to do with them is to, remember how I made them. What I have is this, and these are all radii, everything is radii in here, as originally constructed, so nothing to stop me rotating this around the radii and coming down like that. Now I have I've opened up I know all those edges are identical in length, and they're all freely rotatable about this, so I now have a hexagon. These are all corded. I'm able to extract the hexagon then from the sphere and really know what it is. Is that comfortable to all of you? Remember how I did? I first used my dividers starting at this point and developing a sphere. I'm directional from a point. And then from that, I go to the surface of it. I know every point on the surface is equidistant. So take a point on the surface and I struck this circle out here, surface circle. And I took any point on that surface circle and struck over here and got that length. So I got a chord. This is a chord. I struck that. I know all those three points are equidistant from one another now. It's all constructed that way by my dividers. Same thing over here. And they don't have to be, diametrically opposite, please understand, because you've proven through your dividers going around that this circle struck broke up into much more than two, it broke up into apparently into six. So I just take really quite randomly, because this is a hinge. So these are able to hinge exactly like that. So I now have constructed two tetrahedra, edge to edge. I'm able to open the two tetrahedra out in the flat. And now I find them actually consisting then. Now I know I have a hexagon, which every part has been constructed by the dividers, which is privilege of starting with a whole and working the particular that you couldn't do, get to. It's a synergy. The behavior of that whole is not permitted if you try to start with a part. Has anybody here defined any geometrical fork with what I'm saying? Janet, you're thinking good and hard. Does it seem all right? Good. I haven't found anybody who's ever found any real fork for that. But now I'm really privileged to think tetrahedra. And I really understand how from there on I can reestablish these four great circles. So making these four great circles really part of my game of geometry. It is a very beautiful thing that you had the circle, and then so everything is absolutely superbly proven all the way through. Now I have a very nice kind of a geometrical situation where I can then use the diagonals of these squares and so forth. And I can get my X, Y, Z coordinates. Everything you're familiar with can come out of it from now on in those great circlings that I give you. So all the important coordinates that man has ever used are manifest here and constructed. So that if you want to take things out in the flat, you're extremely comfortable about what the increments are. There was, doing spherical trigonometry, which is dealing in the laws of that right triangle, it's a beautiful thing, Red Cloud, because you, by doing so, you have one thing that is known. That's really great. And then you found that there was a sort of constant variation between the whole of it added up to 180, so that if I make one angle smaller of the non-right angle, the other one's going to be larger. And there's some total always going to be 90 degrees. So you've got two very important things known. You've got a known 90 degrees, you've got a known some of the other two add up to 90. And they're going to be varying, they're going to co-vary with absolute arithmetical accuracy. So this brought about the development of the trigonometric tables. As I gave you yesterday, the maximum variation you really can get to is in the where you have an isosceles, 90 degreeness, and it's an isosceles, and the two corners are 45 each. So 45 is the, inasmuch as they co-vary, 45, the largest gets to be 45, and the smallest gets to be 45. And inasmuch as you learn that, so all you have to know from now on is up to 45. That's why I gave you yesterday all the prime numbers. There's some people who spoke to me, amongst you, about the prime numbers, not quite certain why I carried 2 and others to 2 to the 12th power and 3 to the 8th power and so forth. I simply find that there is in trisecting that goes on. You need 3-ness and 2-ness, and if you get into multiplications, you need a whole lot of 2-ness of the prime number 2. To give you great flexibility in complex computations. But you don't have very often that the prime number 43 comes in. One of that is enough to be sure to accommodate, and if it's in the dividend, it will accommodate all of it. But there's quite a number of recurrences, the 2s and the 3s and the 5s, and you can understand that quite readily. That's why I have many powers of those numbers. And I did not really know, and I haven't got to the control of it yet, how many you would need very certainly. But what I did was to keep going through and developing, multiplying the powers times themselves, and sometimes doubling and tripling, see if I came to interesting numbers. And if you look at your book, Synergetics, you'll find that every so often the numbers are very, very irregular, and suddenly comes out absolutely 9 million. Whatever it is, something incredibly beautiful, simple number. And you say, nature's come in, she's quite come here. She's deliberately made it very simple, sublimely simple. So I began to give these names that are called sublimely rememberable comprehensive dividends. I kept exploring and multiplying, been doing this for years and years. And every so often she came in phase, so I got a listing of those. I used to do all these things longhand. There wasn't any computer to do it with. So I began to get used to the rate at which you accumulate where you have to put something over the next column. So I began then to see that various things looked a little messy. It's simply because there was a spilling only to the left. If that's some way to spill right as well, you might keep up the symmetry. But up to the time you get up to more than 10, so number 7 is what you saw, the 1, 3, 3, 1, then the next one goes 1, 2, 3, so 5 in the middle. So it's a very interesting compound, but suddenly goes beyond 10, then it begins to spill over, and then the symmetry tends to go. I'm so familiar with that makes it, the number I recited to you yesterday is comfortable to me, and I could show you exactly, it's incredible, beautiful cross symmetry, the two sides of it. But some spillings over, and I'm used to how they do, so that's why I can remember it so readily. This is the largest one that I have come to. It is interesting, having done those longhand, I can't tell you how long it used to take to do it and check yourself. Now that we do have a computer, I got some of the big university computers to work in, and all my figures have been checked. This is an absolutely check figure, and it, I feel very, very comfortable about it now. In the early days of navigation, then, because you could solve problems with triangles, and there was yourself and two stars, or there was your ship and the horizon and the star. There were three time and again, to give you some kind of effects. Obviously, they gave you some angle you control. And you could get converging lines of angles. One of the great significances of the models I was giving you to make, and the significance of people not getting things right, was that they didn't tend to have an approach like this, because the perpendicular, you're thinking about perpendiculars of two quadrangles seem to fit this way. You're trying to match surfaces in by parallel motion rather than by convergence. So that we don't where one side reads more than the other, and you find, of course, it's going this way, of course it does. But we do not, the navigator does think in convergent angles. And I find the landsman thinking in parallel. He thinks parallels all the time. He's way over balanced on thinking about the rectilinearity of X, Y, Z, and just the word three-dimensional. I've never seen a scientist go to the board doing a problem when he didn't say superscript 3 always says cube, or superscript 2 just says square. If it's superscript 4, then it says fourth power. But he does not say second power and third power. He's got the absolute identity of that squaring and the cubing. So part of my synergetics has really been, I've had a hard time getting on with people because they still come back talking three dimensions. The word is in there, even though they concede some of the points I make, they go back to three-dimensional thinking. So when we have this lovely convergence, and the convergence does bring you to nuclei. There was nothing in the geometry of the Greeks that there's nucleus. There's no inherent center. There's always boundaries. It's not a game of boundaries. And as I said, they always then accredited only the area that was bound by, and the rest of the universe didn't count. So they had an automatic bias and a really myopic bias of looking at things in a small way. I hope you like doing with me what I am doing. I was trying to understand the significance of the fixation, the conditioned reflexes that are heightened, very greatly heightened by the educational system that make you look at things in a myopic way, rather than the beautiful complementaries that are always there. You can always think in the complementaries, and they're equally rational, and give you a chance then to be very comprehensive and to be synergetic. Now, with navigation, I'm sure many a navigator lost tools that he had, a great sea going on, all things washed overboard, and so the navigator tries to contrive to do things in a very simple way, so those Maori and the Pacific Naga sailormen, as I said, the naked, they had things around there. They could have things around their wrists and arms and their neck that wouldn't come off. That was pretty useful. They could have things in their ears. So these are the only pockets they had. The more I'm certain that probably those rings in the necks of the people are thought of them being sort of such simple people that they're just children that sort of decorate themselves in some superstitious way. I think those rings were literally like the abacus. These are things that slide up and down in the neck, counting devices. And it could be that the person who's wearing it doesn't necessarily know that that's what the navigator uses. Very useful to have different people on board having different kinds of equipment if you're the navigator. So you have several pockets on different people's necks and arms and fingers. Now, we come to days of fancier ships and big ribbed ships, big bellied ships, and getting to great navigation, circumnavigation such as Magellan, Drake, and there are storms and the battles and the things get lost. What are the minimum number of things that the navigator had to have with him to make calculations on how in relation to his observations? And part of the trick of helping that navigator was trying to simplify the number of things you need. Certainly, with calculations have been made, it was very important to have tables of calculations been made. And those were made by monks. And for really up to the time of the computer coming in, even in World War II, But the Great Depression of 1929 and the 30s, the big government projects in America, England, Germany. What are you going to do with the spare time? You're hiring people. One of the things, what do you do with artists and what do you do with scientists? And so there were very large projects in America, mathematical projects, checking the trigonometric function tables. That was a big undertaking. See if you could carry them out into finer degree. It's been done by monks for centuries and centuries. The kind of tables that I first had myself were all monks' tables. And everybody knew there were some errors in them. And there are formulas that were carried out, but also with all these prime numbers washing around, making numbers really where you were very arbitrary about whether you would call it the next higher number or not, which side of the fraction to go, and how many places can you really carry out things with any degree of real accuracy? What did you really know? So five place and six place tables, or five place tables by World War One. That's about all you had really. Then there were all these, the WPA in America, mathematics project, put a great many mathematicians and scientists to work, and they did get up to six places. And strangely enough, the English and the Germans jointly, the English Navy and the German Navy, with Goering's idea, compounded their efforts in those countries developing better trigonometric tables. And they're what called the Edwards, you and I can get today, called Edwards tables, but these were developed by those two, and Goering, with his lookouts, they wanted much better calculating capability, and much swifter calculation to be made in air observations. He really did get the English to go up, and when the war came, then they broke company. But the Germans printed this work, and after World War II, the American Indian Property Custodian in the United States came into Berlin. One of the things that the Americans got a hold of were the German trigonometric tables, and they were published by a firm in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it's called the Edwards Table. And those are good for seven places of accuracy. And when I was able to afford that, this book was quite expensive. I was absolutely broke. I got my Edwards Table as soon as I could. And that was done in increments of seconds, rather than where you had to interpolate between seconds and minutes and so forth up to the degrees. So interpolation was a very important part. But I've done so much trigonometric function calculations that I'm terribly sensitive to the errors I have found, because in getting into geodesic domes, well, I saw that I really could get into comprehensive enclosure, and I could get into omni-triangulated, and I could get into tensegrity. But I saw that if I'm going to bring three struts together in space, I really got to know very accurately two of them might get there, the other one overreaches them, and now trying to buy five and six, they're going to be in very great redundancy. I really had a very great accuracy. In the building world, you'd be interested just to talk about the world that I'd been in when I built those 240 buildings after World War II. In dimensioning of buildings even today, as a workman put together, a quarter inch is a perfectly good tolerance. But if you're building bearings for an automobile, you can't have anything like that, so the automobiles then get down to 10,000 of an inch. In building airplanes today, and the space rocketry, where mild variations, enormous velocity can build in errors, they're dealing in a millionth of an inch. But the building world is still a quarter of an inch kind of stuff. Like, I couldn't have any such nonsense as that when I'm really going to get into this geodesic. So really, I was out to see how I really could reduce stresses and forces. To give you a little example of the significance of what I'm talking about, I was asked to design the dome over the Ford Rotunda Building in Detroit for the 50th anniversary of the Ford Motor Company. Old Henry Ford liked his Rotunda Building very, very much. He used it for Chicago World's Fair. He'd had it moved after the Chicago World's Fair to Detroit, and it was the reception building for the Ford Motor Empire. And he wanted a dome over it. And so his grandson thought for one of the items of the 50th anniversary, it'd be very nice to have a dome put over it. The Ford engineers found that it was a World's Fair structure, very light steelwork, and that it could not take the load of the dead weight of a dome. It could theoretically take the snow loads, but the best known ways to build domes, they were called radial arch domes by this time, with steel, the weights ran way over what the building could take, and they had to really rebuild the whole building. And young Henry was very disappointed, and his cousin, another Ford, had heard about my geodesics and familiar with it, and suggested that they ask me to come out and see what I could do. So I suddenly had a call from the Ford Motor Company. And I'm concerned, I was really very much of an unknown this time, and said I could come out, and I thought somebody was kidding me. So they said, come out to Detroit, and sure enough, they got a very fancy automobile rushing out the rotunda, looking it over. They said, could I put a dome over it? And I said, yeah. And said, could you make some calculation about it away? And so I did. And the calculations, they didn't tell me their dilemma. And my calculation came out well within the tolerance limits. So they decided to go ahead with me. And they were the engineers and the Ford operating management were tremendously skeptical of this character coming into their company and doing something like that. So it was a very wonderful operation. I showed you yesterday struts of where you could just take sheet metal and bend it. In the world of aluminum, we'd gotten up to very high tensile strengths with World War II. Aluminums have, as we entered it before, we were 20,000 pounds a square inch was about it. During the war, a Japanese alloy came in, it was a 71 ST. We got up to 71,000 pounds a square inch with mild steel, 60,000, 50,000. So it was very strong. It was equivalent to the kind of strength you got in the first Brooklyn Bridge. And it had only one third of the weight of the steel. So it was very, very high advantage metal. I could really only get it in sheet form. And there's nothing quite so the thing that a man produces in such quantity and such speed as sheet. Whether sheet steel or sheet aluminum or paper. So if one really takes something he has for membranes and control environment, the sheet is very advantageous. So I found like take my sheet and with the brake, you can bend and make your angles. And we got into, well, they're quite fancy angles. They're not just an angle like that, a 60-degree angle. That's 70 degrees, 32 minutes business. And they were also, they had those secondary ribbings along the edge so that the edges of the metal were not curled and so forth. So actually it was a V like this. This way this thing's carried out its best strength. I was able to deal with a very lightweight sheet of 0.032, where you got 3 square feet of material for a pound of metal. And so I designed the dome with that. And then where the parts overlap, they had to be riveted. It'd been learned during World War II in the riveting of airplanes, with enormous production of airplanes, rivet holes were of greatest importance. So parts would be made here and parts there. Could you bring parts with holes punched in them, bring them great complex to them and still have them all registered and have rivets come in? Those are some of the production tricks that the Germans and English had developed. The United States inherited a lot of these techniques with extraordinary kind of controls of lights focusing on metals and so forth and using light sensitive things that punched and so forth. Anyway, then discovered, thinking about what kind of strength differences do you get in the airplane where you have two holes and they're a little off like that and a rivet has to be then small enough so it go between the two because there's a little slack in it. Got into an enormous amount of testing and laboratory testing of the relative strengths arrived at where as you got better registering of the two holes as far as the center of the holes go and the hole sizing, and they found that the strengths went up very, very rapidly as you got the greater accuracy, both the positioning and the sizing of the hole and the sizing of the rivet that slid in. For a fairly simple reason, if there was a slop in it, it could be everything's fastened down good and tight, but a big stress on the thing, if there's a little more slop opening in this particular direction, something she starts sliding. You yield all the thousands of it, you get a little slop in this side, you yield in that direction. Let's start a shearing action, things begin to go. So if the shearing can't start, it's almost like having a pole that is balanced. You have a pole balanced in a finger, and there's nothing really to keep that, no effort really to keep that. Can you keep on that dead center? And if you don't, as you get off it, things can, it takes much more effort to withstand and keep where you like it. So, when I did the Ford Motor Company dome, I also found the best people in the Ford Motor Company by far were the tool men who made the mass production tools. They are the brownies of Detroit. No matter how the management, they're the ones that get things tooled up and get ready for 3 years from today when they start selling things. But they're the people who really are keen. And the tooling men liked what I did. And I designed the rivet holes for there were some thousands of these struts, and many, many thousands of them, some 50,000 or so. And I designed the rivet hole positionings, and the rivets themselves, we kept the tolerance to 10,000ths of an inch. Now, bringing 10,000ths of an inch into a big building where the quarter of an inch had been fine, you imagine the general contractors, when I faced them, this said, you can't have any nonsense like that. So I said, I have designed all the tooling. I've designed all your logistics. As general contractor, I said, I'll handle the whole thing for you. There's nothing. You really have to do nothing but just write out the checks and pay the bills. And so I then had to put on a show for the Ford Motor Company in my office. I took an office in Detroit where I gave them complete logistics of the complete design of every part, how every part was to be manufactured, how they'd be organized at the job, how it'd be assembled, the roof, what workmen would do each job, and how many there'd be. I spelled out the absolute whole thing. And the general contractor said he'd never had anything done like that before. This is the kind of work his estimators and engineers had to go to work and do, and he found it all done for him. So he was really very grimly surprised. That helped me a lot. It was an operation that was very difficult because the Ford Motor Company had already been spending a lot of money getting things ready for the 50th. They actually had invested over $25 million in TV shows and a big show they're putting on. And so they didn't want the work they were already doing being messed up. There's something going on overhead. So I had to build a bridge across this thing, and I used a high voltage cross continent mast glow to the top of it with this bridge going across, and introduced a hydraulic arm that went upwardly and revolved around. We mounted the dome. They were very scared about the danger of the man working it. So there's enormous steel arms that went around with the dome on it, and people could reach it from the bridge. They didn't have to go up the scaffolding anywhere. And we were able then to continually revolve the dome going up, and they keep adding on to the bottom of it from the bridge so nobody went low. Until it was all up, and then we let it down onto the actual parapet of the roof, so that all that had to be calculated very accurately. There'd be no stresses in that. And the roof was not very beautifully done, so I had to really allow for all kinds of come and go, shimming of the thing. So, anyway, the work that I laid out, there were certain number then of hole patterns for there were six prime variations, and the Ford tooling men made up class A steel dies to stamp out the parts and to punch the holes. They were able to pre-punch the holes in the flat So they got in the bending. But everything was under such tight controls that I kept this down to a 1/10 of an inch. Now, the interesting thing is that the dome weighed exactly 1/2 what it would have weighed if it had been laid out by the best sheet metal workers in the world at the tolerance the sheet metal worker can lay out. I had absolutely under these invisible tolerances. And the dome was, you have exactly 2 domes for one, same amount of metal, simply by that tolerance difference. But that could be that, when you get that kind of economy and inherent and competence, you really understand the reason why I would feel that I'm not putting it upon you to take some of your time to begin to get into the subject of the geometry and how we can do good calculations and so forth. Now I'm going to come back to a man and as a navigator going around the world, you're trusting this great ship and all the people in it and an enormous commitment to this navigator to get you from there, going in unknown seas and don't know where the rocks are, and you're sailing at night and you can't stop the wind blowing in this direction. It's a very hazardous undertaking. And so Napier in England developed some very beautiful rules in trigonometry to simplify the navigator's problems so that he couldn't make what he called a 180-degree error. Because of these quadrants, X, Y, Z quadrants are going around, it's really very easy to make a plus or minus error and find yourself going in exactly the opposite direction where you ought to be going. So he simplified this out, and he then developed a game of calculation trigonometrically, which you could find in Bowditch's Practical Navigator, which was the Bible of navigation for the United States Navy, for the Naval Academy, and you still find it there. But I'm going to give you these rules because I found it very useful. All through the years immediately, just before the Ford Motor Company dome, a few years after, I found myself being invited all around the world to architecture schools, and whether it would be in Ghana, or it'd be in India, and so forth, I would have a class of students, and they would vary from 18 to possibly 30 in number. And I would teach them then all of this mathematics, and I would teach them then how we calculate geodesic domes and everything. And we would then literally make organized production. I would organize the students into aeronautical production, how to develop prototypes and get into production in aeronautics, using that kind of techniques. And there was purchasing to be done, so forth and so on. Really got the students immediately hooked up with real life. Not only did they get them hooked up with real life, but they found, time and again, we had Cornell, the president of DuPont happened to be a friend of, he had a student, a son up there at Cornell. He was interested. One reason or another, there'd be somebody you could get in touch with, and he said, we're going to make an experiment. We really, you know, you've been going through this not really using the most advanced materials, and we understand you have a little better clear plexiglass where it is, and these men were sent you special airplane material, so they found enormous cooperation on the part of industry, began to give enormous insights. The students are organized in teams with purchasing agents and mathematics, had a mathematics department, design engineering and the production engineering, installation engineering, all the logistics were worked out, everything we did. This is what I call comprehensive participatory design science. You're responsible for everything. I'm responsible for how it's going to be removed and so forth. Just one sort of last word reflectively on that Ford Motor Company dome. When they finished lowering that dome onto, and it really worked, and people climbed over it and it was finished, the head of the Ford Motor Company's engineering department said, I not only congratulate you, they'd been very quiet with me, but he said, I'm going to dismay you very much to tell you what I'm going to tell you, but he said, we were so sure you couldn't do it that we had paid in advance. We paid the contractor because it was going to have to be done so fast. He required a premium. We paid him in advance. We paid the contractor to remove all your unfinished, no good work to get so we can go on with our show. We assumed it wouldn't be done. But we're paying him much more than we're paying you for a very beautiful, successful job. Well, they really felt very conscience stricken about it, and as a consequence, the Ford Motor Company went way out of the way to tell the Air Force, who were going on my radomes and didn't know, they couldn't understand why they seemed to work, and the engineers couldn't calculate they didn't work. The Ford Motor came and gave them to me terrific send off, and that's one reason why geodesic knowledge really did proliferate so rapidly, as a consequence of that project. Coming back now to the Napier developing a trick for the navigator, he got down to very simple devices. Assuming you still had held on somehow to your tables and could look things up, if you couldn't, the navigator might know his mathematics well enough to know how you arrive at each of these calculations. That's a fairly simple kind of formula. You could get yourself within good sort of tactical range, where you're within 100 miles where you are, possibly in some case down to 10 miles where you are. Napier made this diagram, and incidentally, in trigonometry, if we're dealing with sphericals, we draw a triangle like this. We put a little curvature in it, and you can see quite easily whether you're going to really is a 90-degree. I meant to draw that for a 90-degree corner, so this is a 90-degree, and this is corner is big C. This is big A, this is big B. And the side opposite C is little C, and this is little B, and this is little A. That's the standard convention in trigonometry. Then Napier developed a diagram where he had big A here, big B. And so this would be little a here, and this would be little b here, and this little c here. Then he put a complementary little c of modifying those three. This is his basic diagram. If you can remember that diagram, that's all you really need, so you never get into trouble. Because then he said, I'm going to make a rather poor poem, but you can probably remember it. And it said, the sine of any part will always equal the product of the tangents of the adjacent or the, use the word cosine, ops and cosine. He made a rhyme out of, and tangents and adjacents. He made out of it. Equal the sine of the product. Sine of any part will always equal in the product of the cosines of the opposites or the tangents of the adjacents. If you remember that statement, it's not too difficult. The sine of any part will always equal the products, the cosines of the opposites and product of the tangents of the adjacents. And then I'll show you what it means by opposites and adjacents. So, let's say, this is 90 degrees, and you've learned that the one thing you know is this is 30 degrees. So you can look up the sine of 30 degrees. No, excuse me. I'm going to say what I have known in my... Here, maybe I know that's 30 degrees, okay? And I know that little b is 22 degrees and some minutes, whatever it is, 30 degrees and 20 minutes. But I know two parts. So what I know is little b I know little B, and I know big A. Okay, I've got to find then something called ops. Well, they are beside each other. Therefore, I've got to get something opposite to. So I can say the sine of little a, and every time I write little a, I've got to put a the c above it. Sine of little a equals, these are ops, the cosine of big A times the cosine of little b. Also putting a little like that. Now I've got my formula written out, and I've got to substitute where the C's occur. I've got to get that out of the thing. These are put in there so you can't make the 180-degree error. So then you convert the C, you revert to, so this side, instead of being sine, has to be read cosine. Cosine of little a equals cosine of big A times the sine of little b. Because this is opposite of cosine. Now I've got a formula that I can look up my tables what the sine and so forth are, and I've got to multiply them. So if you also then have your, those days we used to use log, so you had the log of any of those numbers, and all you had to do was add them instead of multiplying them. So trigonometric tables were usually also given with the logs in those days. So you look up your logs and you simply add it or subtract it, whatever you had to do. It's fine. So this gave you then, by this time, so now you've learned what little a is, and you go on to find out with the other parts very, really very rapidly. This is a very fantastic, simple thing I've given you here. That's all there is to it. Now, there are many other formulas in trigonometry, I assure you. And there are special kinds of tasks to be done, and there are some really quite fancy formulas for doing it. But this is the essence. You can get today, Hewlett-Packard has a little computer, and that's now down to $350, or you can get a $750 one. But it has all the trigonometric function and everything on it, and you can do all the problems in this little computer. The $750 one, they now have programs, strips that you can put in, and so that it's something you did quite regularly, you don't just put in a 5 frequency, a 4 frequency, all of it, and you get your answers just like wham, wham, what the length of every part is in the building. Once you've discovered then what the trigonometry is for a radius is 1, then I showed you here before. You want to build a geodesic dome. And what I need to know is the length of a structural member. So what I really want to know is from here to here. I want to know the chords instead of the arcs. So what I do when I get what my angle is, I know then that the chord is 2 times the sine of 1/2. Theta. So this is quite different. You can't just automatically multiply and let's look up to a larger angle. You can't do that. Because I want you to realize the difference between that. Because these things are, this would be the chord of that. That's not at all that number. So you can't just take, it's 2 times the sine of half theta, and just never kid yourself about that. So this one I have, then I began developing what are called chord factors, the phrase never been used, so I can give you, geodesic domes, I give you the chord factors for any radius, so all you have to know is your radius. And you can do it in meters or centimeters, anything you want, but so as people began to catch on what I was doing, then they found you should publish all the geodesic domes in various frequencies and the chord factors, and that's all they had known, you start putting it together as you don't. So I can tell you, when I first did the first calculations for geodesics, there were no electric computers whatsoever. There were no kinds of everything had to be done longhand. You did have your large tables, and you did have rather poor tables. They didn't have the edges. So it was very clear to me, coming at things the way I do, you're used to my kind of argument, that I'm the triangle of the sphere, and particularly as was tensegrity of his operative, but was simply going to make, because tension has no limit, therefore a tensegrity dome would have no limit. That all the arch domes had very limited clear spans, and St. Peter's was the largest in the world at the time of main Memphis, it is 150 feet in diameter. And I looked at it as a very large sizes. They're no longer building the domes with bricks and so forth, and having chains around them where you did Santa Sofia or St. Peter's, but they were doing what they call radial arch, and had great enormous steel beams running from the perimeter all the way up, which made a very long beam. The slenderness ratio had very heavy, and then they had a centering steel ring, and they were all brought to that centering steel ring, and the weights involved were enormous. Then they began to learn they could make them a little lighter, and then they began cross-triangulating. Well, this is what came out of my geodesic to the triangulation, so they began to find you can make those radios a little lighter by cross-triangulation. Anyway, my first calculations, I could see that the thing had probably worked. And somebody, supposing few human beings had thought that before, the whole thing was doing calculations so things would come out accurately. It's not a game you could be just rough about. Things really would collapse. You know, errors would accumulate very, very rapidly as you went around the great circle. So, my wife had a little money this time. She decided to really help me buy time. We bought the time. And I'm sure this is the reason why people had done it, because it was really going to take time. It took me 2 years to do the first calculation, really didn't know the score. And today, anybody with a computer, you really not run this out in a couple of, less than a half an hour, you knock out a dome. And nobody realizes the enormous advantage that has really moved forward to the man with calculating capabilities. And the computer's carrying out tables to very many places and so forth. So that the accuracies are very, very great today. To me, one of the most interesting challenges here was that the calculator, if I hadn't done whole number, longhand work, I would not realize the significance of numbers. If you put it in the computer, you just miss it, getting a simple answer. So I realized I really tended to make an exploration about the last moment in history where you'd be have the opportunity to really find something out, and that I'd better really pay fantastically strict attention all the way through here to the significance of everything as it went along. This kind of talk I'm having with you tonight, then, is to do with what I call design science, comprehensive anticipatory design science. You deal with things some totally in the terms of total resources, everything you know about the way the universe is working, how and why we have the energies available here, why there is a biosphere, and how you really then employ the resources of physical resources and the knowledge to the highest advantage for all humanity, and if possible to sustain all humanity for all generations to come. That is your challenge. And you must be responsible for how every way you participate in the transformations of nature, employing those principles, you must be responsible how this thing gets where it's going to go, you must be responsible how it's working there, and how you take it away, and how you get recirculation again. You must be responsible for the complete cycle. There's no point where you're not, well, whatever you produce is now melted up and being used by somebody else. But as far as you're using those resources, you must be responsible from beginning to end. I gave you a way of realizing yesterday in big patterns. The metals are occurring all around the earth, and therefore there's a halfway around the world you give God the final ball, and they gradually converge till they get to maximum separation apart, then they get into reassociation in preferred ways, and then when they are, they finally have such advantage of man to really justify such a big operation, you have to get, make them available to the most people around the world. So it means you have to send them halfway around the world again to make them available. So that's the size of the operation. And often really doing things the right way is much easier than doing it the wrong way. At any rate, I never find myself shuddering at the size of the problem, and every one of the projects that I have undertaken, and in our, tomorrow we're going to go over a lot of the projects I have undertaken, were always undertaken on this kind of a basis, and all students who ever worked with me have learned how I feel utterly responsible all the way through to humanity for having tampered at all with all this extraordinary phenomenon we learn about. I show you the kind, this kind of carrying on is a very inspiring matter. It makes you tremendously conscious of everybody and why everybody's doing what they're doing in this particular moment. I can understand why they're preoccupied. I can understand the fears of that father about his kid's going to be able to eat, if whether he's going to lose his job. I understand all those things. And so I feel very, very kin to everybody. Not at all annoyed at non-cooperation. But you have to find out then how you get it done. And you keep at it until suddenly you begin to find there are ways of getting things done. Now, I've been giving you a few sort of clues of the, I'm always looking for the simplest also. So nice to get this thing out of the way. That's the language of words, and they should not feel formidable at all. It's a really very simple kind of thing, because that is a tangent line. And you can understand what is really cotangent. You can see all that. It's really very self-explanatory. The only word, sine, see, this is the withoutness, the openings. It is really to do with angles, how much the angle is open. You see that, that's a very nice measure. Because it's in the central angle. I think that is enough of talking about that diagram and talking about Napier. And I'm now going to switch over to tensegrity structures. Because all the geometries that I have been identifying for you in the terms of topological analysis and volumetric analysis, energy analysis, quantum and so forth, all of those geometries can be made tensegrity. As I point out to you also, one of the things that inspired me very early in the game of structures was getting into the push-pulls and how they're accomplished, and finding that I went over that with you, the compressions were at limited lengths in relation to cross-section, and tension didn't, we went into all that. Discovering that the universe is actually designed with islanded compression, usually spherical, as the most effective use of the energy that way, and the whole thing cohered tensionally. And the tension is the compressions are inherently discontinuous, and the tension is inherently continuous. Now, the universe is inherent continuous tension. And that was not the way man was building. But when I found all the geometries and all these interrelations, all this coordination, I was looking for nature's own coordinating system. I was sure it was rational due to the chemistry. I found the rational coordinating system. And I found then that all the geometries could be produced in tensegrity. I was looking for this, and then I had the word. At Black Mountain College, I was a visiting professor the summer of 58 and 59. I was a summer dean. And there was a student there in 58 and 59, both, Ken Snelson. He'd been in the Navy, and his father was a photographic camera store man in Oregon. And Ken had a great he's fantastically expert in cameras, movie pictures and still, but he had a real feeling about art, he liked painting. He'd come to Black Mountain and encounter his paintings and to study with Albers there. And Kent Nelson fell in love. I talked to him again, my energetic geometry. He's absolutely in love with my energetic geometry. And he was incredibly good at model making, so that for a whole year after Black Mountain, he came to New York or wherever I was and worked with me. And I went out to the Institute of Design in Chicago, and Kent Nelson moved out to Chicago. Then, in the second summer at Black Mountain, Ken showed me a sculpture he had made, and in an abstract world of sculpture, what he had made was a 10-segment structure, and he had a structural member out here, two structural members out here that were not touching the base. They were held together, they were in tension, and I explained to Ken that this was a 10-segment. The man I'd found had only developed tensegrity structure in wire wheels and in universal joints. Universal joints where he had a steel shaft, and the reason for needing a universal joint because you're changing the angle of the drive, and he had two shafts, and each one of them came to three arm points like this. Tetrahedrally, like this. They had forged members, steel, and came to a pad with a hole in the end of the pad. So there were three pad holes, tripods like this, and they would bring those together at 60 degrees from one another with a flexible disc. And they would try all kinds of fabrics and leathers and so forth to see how long they would last. They would then rivet these onto that flexible disc, and as they drove this way, the disc would accommodate. In other words, it was a tensional interconnection. The man had used tensegrity in this drive shaft for the universal joints. He also made it with a wire wheel where he had an island of compression at the hub and an atoll of compression at the rim, and the whole thing was tensionally coherent. So that this is the only place I found a man that actually had tensegrity. So when Ken Nelson showed me this little extension thing he did, was really just an arbitrary form. He saw that you could do it, but he was just, as an artistic form, something so startling to look at. And I said, Ken, that really is the 10-segment, and it's what I'm looking for, because what you've done, I can see it relates to the octahedron, and this gives me a clue how this goes together, all the energetic geometry. So Ken opened up my eyes to the way to go into the geometry. And Ken himself is an artist. He's gone on to make all kinds of tensegrity sculptures that are getting to be very well known as one of the most in demand artists. But Ken himself kept himself alive by doing moving picture work. He had got a moving picture cameraman's union card, and he turned out to be really one of the best. Any time he wanted to work, he'd go and make a whole lot of money on some big project, and then go back and commit himself to his artwork. At all times in my carrying on, I have come to phases where I could see that something might be attractive from an art form. Continually get insights. I suddenly see new panels in the people's feet, and this could really be extremely interesting. I know personally, I'm deeply moved by it, that I could exploit it by stopping just being an artist. But that was my commitment. I told you last night, my whole commitment was to be absolutely responsible, to never exploit for self, and never just for self or fame, or whatever. You must not exploit. And if people try to make you feel fancy, then you must do everything you can to be sure that is deflated. So that I've never gone off of these forms, but it is interesting how many I've enormous number of artist friends, and they're really deep friends, and they're very sympathetic what I do, and they do then go off and they like what I can find out also technically, which gives a chance to do various things, and it couldn't be more beautiful life than I've had with my artist friends. I cannot talk about tensegrity without talking about the fact that Ken Nelson really was a catalyst to my discovering how I really connect this up with all the jobs and all the coordination, everything I want to do, doing more with less. And so I'm now going to go into the 10th sanctity with you and give you a little feeling. But I also did, earlier in that time, talk to you about pneumatics and 10th sanctity, showing you how and why it did get into regularities. So we don't have to go into that. You'll recognize that as we go. May I have the first picture? Here I am also pointing out to you that where we have a balloon or a football or somebody said, let's think about it, it's impervious. But if you look at it with a very fine microscope, it's full of holes. The only thing is the holes are smaller than the molecules of the gas that are inside. So they're really like a fish net, where the fish net is smaller than the fish, so the fish simply hits the net. And I saw them really operating very much as fish, the molecules of gas hitting the bag, and hitting it so many places, but give it whatever its stretchable shape is, it takes that shape. So you can make strange-looking balloons of special shapes, so it always can push it out of me. Next picture. Then this represents, look at the upper right-hand side, or middle right-hand side, what I gave you, the two swimmers coming together and shoving off from each other, and then hitting, going caroming off the, cause, and there's no line that you can make inside there, unless it's a radius, that wouldn't be a chord. Could be a very deep chord, or it could be a very light chord. And if I'm really going around like that, hitting the skin a glancing blow. Now, because the two of them, action, reaction, shove off from each other, and they each hit the skin a glancing blow. The fact is then that a chord, an arc, it stays in the circle, but the chord, the center of the chord is nearer the center of the circle than on its end. So its ends are always emerging, hitting the skin at a very small angle. And there's a net of the two, one going this way and then both pushing out of it, means it's a single force going out like that. And the magnitude of that force is governed a great deal by that angularity of this. But there's a frequent enough episode, it keeps it all moving out. So you can get the bag harder by putting more gas in, so it increases the frequency of the hitting very, very, very greatly. Next picture. Then I showed you how that, what seemed to be the randomness, automatically worked itself into the circles and the omni-triangulation. And the hexagons and the pentagons are simply incidental to the triangles here. The triangles are here. These are the spaces between the triangles do all the stabilizing. Next picture. Now the simplest. Could that picture be dropped or turn it sideways? Can we go to the sideways? The simplest thing you can do for a 10th sanctity is two members like that. I have there one that's bowed like this, and the other bowed like that. A precessional effect, two coming together. These are very much like take a tetrahedron. I got two balls that's coming like that at each other. Or let's take a tetrahedron, it consists of four triangles, or pair them into two diamonds. You take two diamonds and precess and come like this and grasp each other. That's exactly the way you make a baseball. And a baseball skin with two lobes in it, like a tennis skin, is really two of those balls. It is each lobe is a triangle of a tetrahedron, but you can then also draw as a circle, and then have the between the two complement that same radius. So you have two pairs of triangles, two pairs of triangles, precessors come like that and grasp each other, and that's your baseball. Incidentally, your baseball, if you draw it, is quite interesting. As it is this. It's yin-yang. The yin yang is two compromises, not in a plane, but really in the universe. And the baseball form is exactly it. This uniform radius all the way through. It's a lovely thing. Baseball is telling you precession. It's telling you, the yin yang to me tells me a great deal of the, I'm sure the Chinese thought in the terms of the whole too. And they came to a flat representation. But I'm sure they were thinking this way. And so they really felt the power of that yin yang. So the complementaries do precess like this. Okay. So in this first one here, I have, you can't take two straight sticks like this. You can if you want. And they are two edges of a tetrahedron. Makes a very flat tetrahedron. All you have to do is to have one tension member go right around. You call it a kite. You can make a diamond-shaped kite. You don't have to fasten these two to each other because it's simply a very flat tetrahedron and push it. Tighter you make the perimeter, the tighter this comes against it here. But it doesn't have to be fastened. It's the beginning of tensegrity. So it's a two-member tensegrity. So the two-member tensegrity is really then a pre-sectional affair. But there's a little set of arc, a little like this, but the pull of those lines will make them do this little to each other. That's what that model is that I have there. You can see how you can take a ship now, a Naga ship, the great ends, and the ends come out of the water like that. And you could have a spar going like this in the sky, which you then supported from the ends of that spar to the ends of the ship here, not the other end of the spar. That's the other end of the ship is sticking out of the water quite far. Then you have to have a tension, fore and aft tension, to the top of this thing so it wouldn't fall over. It'd be quite possible to make a boat that way, and I'm surprised that people have not built boats this way, because it would be possible to have to drop sails from this thing, just connected in tension. I think we probably will see just such a device one of these days, because we'll get into very, very lightweight, instead of having a mast that has to go vertical like that. This is a very, very much lower thing, yet can drop you a great square sail and give you an enormous amount of sail. Okay, anyway, that's as simple as tensegrity. Next picture, please. The next one is one where you make the octahedron. It has X, Y, Z coordinates, and I think I suggest you try this someday, and before you put tension from end to end, you take a box, say a cubicle box, and you tape one of the tubes onto it. The box has six faces, so we go another face here, and I have one going that way, and it has the X, Y, Z coordinates. Fastened onto the box, but a little away from each other. You understand that? Taped on. Then you take your tensions, omni-triangulate, that has eight triangles in high tension. Then you remove the box to the center, and you find they just don't touch each other. So here we have very clearly the non-touchingness of the octahedron. And it makes it quite possible that with a little mild bowing by the tensioning to make them quite fairly accurate. We find in nature all the crystals that are octahedron or whatever they may be always have they're askew one way or the other. They're always turbining the one way or the other. Now this was turbine, there are two ways of turbining this. Now the next picture. No, I haven't come to it yet. This is a four member. I had three members, now I have four struts. This is a tetrahedron made by Ken Snelson. It's really very fascinating tetrahedron, it's a four strut tetrahedron. And it relates then to the vertexes and the opposite faces. You have a suspension of the opposite face. Next picture. I'm showing that a second time just to give you a little familiarity with it. Next picture, please. Now here's a tensegrity tetrahedron with six edges, six struts instead of the central angles which Ken Snelson uses, pushing out to a tension perimeter. Here we have the perimeter are the compression members. And we find that they again turbine, as you found it did just in the octahedron is a fundamental turbining. It can be positive or negative, but turbining you're going to have to do. And so it's good fun to make this tetrahedrine tetrahedron. And this tetrahedrine tetrahedron, you can slide the compression members on the tension member on the outside there. Next picture. Now I have two tensegrity octahedra. One is positive and the other is negative. You can see them there. One twist positive, other negative. Next, and then I bring the two together. Next picture. And they make then the two pairs of parallels. You got six of them. There were three in the two octahedra. One was positive and negative. They come together and give you then this balance. Both positive and negative. It's a very, very stable form. And it has six members, therefore 12 ends. And the 12 ends are exactly congruent with the 12 vertexes of an icosahedron. So this turns out to be an icosahedron. And you can see connecting other tension members from the ends that are not connected, how those triangles could all be completed. Next picture. On the right, then, I have six members in the form of the tetrahedron. And the second one, I'm sliding the compression members along on the tensors towards their centers. They get to the center, they become the octahedron, and on the end, the same six become the icosahedron. So you see, same six, one, six quanta. Remember, six compression with quanta, one unit of quanta. Six, same quantum, six. One quantum is being either the tetrahedron, which is the simplest structural system in the universe, or they can be the octahedron, which is the next, and the icosahedron. But the icosahedron, remember, gave us the most volume with the least energy investment. The tetrahedron gave us the least. It was the stiffest of any load against any vertex, much more trouble to push on the tetrahedron, where the tripod is steep, and when it's flat, it gets down flatter, easy to push it in. So that the tetrahedron has the greatest strength with the least volume of the three fundamental structure systems in the universe, and the icosahedron has the most volume with the least surface, so that you decide exactly which you want. In fact, I decided I would take icosahedra and fortify each of the local triangles with local tetrahedron. So you can take those local higher loads, and that is exactly really the design of that Ford motor coming to dome. So it came out octahedron plus geodesic. Next picture. Now we get into more multiples again. This is on Ed Applewhite's lawn in Washington. And this is the 30 strut tensegrity. And then it begins to multiply quite rapidly in higher and higher frequency. This is a two frequency icosahedral tensegrity. Next picture. That is the same thing. And this is the model I made in Japan, because the Japanese became very, very interested in this. Next picture. That's the same. Next picture. This is a model I made of it also. Still is the two-frequency tensegrity, but it's an extraordinarily delicate model made by the students for me in Ghana. These are the mahogany struts, and they did a really excellent jewelry kind of work of connection. The tension connections are so delicate you can hardly see them. They same students then made me a 40-foot tensegrity sphere using mahogany. It was the only really good compression we had there, and we had to use fence wire, cow fence wire. It had made it extraordinary, and so it's much heavier than you like being made out of mahogany. But it was a beautiful thing, and the students, I'll never forget when they really finished that structure. The engineering department followed all the way through. They sure it wouldn't work, and it certainly did work, and worked superbly. But when they finished it, the students ran with it across the campus, the flat central campus, with it overhead, and the shriekings and the callings out, they really went back into very early war cries. These are the most greatest warriors of Africa, and they really got into that kind of exaltation as they ran forward this film. But they had it on the campus and did not tie it down properly, and they had a full hurricane about a month or so after, and the hurricane really picked it up in the sky and quite high, and it came down as a ball upside down and didn't hurt it at all. I assure you, this made the engineers look at it all the more carefully. It was a heavy dome. And next picture, please. Now we're looking at I wish that could all be in the picture. This is a beautiful dome made by the students at the University of Oregon, and it is a very high frequency, and is a great big one. At the moment that we're looking at, I think this picture is of me from behind me. Anyway, they had worked on, this was about a sixth frequency, and worked terribly hard on it, and it was a beautiful affair. It was higher than this room. It was a big sphere. And we finished it, and I said this, now, this is pneumatics, and it will bounce. And I said, do you dare drop it? They've been putting this together, making it for 2 weeks, and so we're all holding it out there. It's very light. And so you really have to go along with your theory. So finally, said, sure enough, we literally let go and came bust right back to our hands, right around. Mm-hmm. Next picture. This is a model at the University of Minnesota getting ready for what are called the geoscope. Again, these miniaturists, and I've talked to you about that before. And they were planning to have a 40-foot, you know, a 100-foot miniaturist on the campus at Minnesota. And this is the model we were making. It was tensegrity. It was very exciting when I'll show you photographs. I hope that I have them with me here. We've got into making the struts then in polyester fiberglass cigars. There were struts about 10 feet long, and using beautiful flexible aircraft cable, very high chrome nickel cable. We then made a quite large section of the actual 100-footer, and sure enough, it worked, and so there was great excitement on the campus about that. We did not have time to finish that, and again, I'm sorry to say, when my university projects, I go away, and the budgeting of different departments are poor, and when I'm there, I literally spend my own money on the project, and then they didn't have enough money to carry on. So that thing got deteriorated. They had it in a field house for a few months, and then had to take it apart and never got put together again. The next picture, the students at Princeton, this model, and next picture, please. They then put up this was a 40-foot diameter tensegrity on the campus of Princeton, down near the research laboratories of the architecture department. And you can see, I think, a man standing in the middle down there. It's a very big sphere. We had it hanging from 5 telephone posts we put in, out like that. So it was hung tension inside of that. And the amazing thing happened, because have you seen the even tensioning we have? Unfortunately, a lumber truck backed up into it on the far side. And what happened was the stress went all the way around on the side, 180 degrees from where the truck hit it, the strut bent. All the forces went completely around and focused on one point, like a radio wave. Again, a snowplow ran into it that next winter, and again, 180 degrees away, another one got bent. So there were two bent ones up in the sky there. This dome brought a great deal of interest at Princeton. It was a time when Einstein was there, and And Sandy Old Man went over and looked at it a great deal. And all the scientists said they were really very much very, very taken aback by discontinuous compression. There's another one which I'll show you here, which I had on the campus at MIT, and it will be coming up in a little bit. Next picture, please. This is that one at Princeton again, and I think you may be able to see one of those bent ones up there in the far right middle side. Next picture. This is the largest tensegrity we've ever built, and that was at University, Southern Illinois University, and it was 72-footer as a 12-frequency truncatable, as you could cut it off at four different places, as well as being tensegrity. Now, and you could do that on six different axi, where you could fractionate this in fractional spheres. As you see, as you get higher and higher frequency, the chord and the arc get closer and closer to one another. So the arc altitude continually decreases. As you get to a smaller central angle, the arc altitude will decrease. That's pretty clear. So when we get a high frequency, we get where just the thickness of the material of the strut uses up the arc altitude. So at Southern Illinois University, we deliberately, the mathematics for that 12-frequency truncatable were the mathematics done originally by the students at Kumasi Gano, and they produced a very extraordinary aluminum dome down there, which I'll talk to you more about, which is a beautiful self-cooling air, a chilling machine, as they called it. That's the aerodynamics of it. Somebody made cold air inside. The hotter got outside, the cooler got inside. As long as the sun is shining, it worked that way. Now, the mathematics of that, I found the Africans had extraordinary joy and appetite for mathematics. They had quite a few electric calculators there on the campus at Kumasi Gano. I had 70 students in my project there. And in an American project at the university, when I get the individual students to choose which team they'd like to be on, if they're on a function that only lasts for a while, then they can finish that and go on to another function. So they all elect which ones they'd like to do, whether they'd like to be purchasing agent, they'd like to be public relations. Incidentally, all projects like that, you've got to have public relations. The world is going to ask you what it is you're doing there. And you're going to have a very, very well organized. So this is not just out of the world, it's the world. And the world is, you're fooling with the frontier of the world, of humanity. So it has great interest. There must be a very good public relations man, and highly responsible. Anyway, supposing you are then, might be on the mathematics team or engineering. In American, out of a school, out of 30 students, my average would be 3 or 10% would like to be in the mathematics team. In the Kumasi Gana, the Africans, out of 70, 50% wanted to be on the mathematics team. They love mathematics, and they're incredibly good at it. When I hear Western world, white-skinned people talk about the dark-skins, if they do not have intellectual capability, they're a little slow. There are the effects of bad nutrition and so forth, but the point is that anybody's ever heard the drums of the different tribes of Ghana, and they do come together annually, these different extraordinary tribes, and with their different kind of drummings, and have beautiful tape recording made of them. Anybody know the music they have in them, you understand how and fundamentally mathematically coordinate they are. They're spontaneous, and they just love it. Anyway, they did develop this very complex 12-frequency truncatable, which we did use at Southern Illinois University. And we then, using the figures, came to the say, what size, if you were using 2x4s, which is the most plentiful way in which lumber is produced, and if we use not free, highest strength 2x4s that are produced, which turned out to be there are two kinds. There's a yellow pine, and there's an Oregon fir that have this high strength. And we then took the way in which the 2x4 dresses out. It's not 4 inches, it's 3 3/4 approximately, and not 2 inches, it's 1 7/8. And you take your dressing size. We then calculated what size dome using trial frequency, truncatable, would become where the arc altitude was exactly 3 3/4 inches, which was the way that it was. So that if you made it that way, see, in sensitivity, one strut goes over the other, one inside the other. Could we go back to one of those sensitivity struts? One before this, picture before it. You see, a strut goes under another one like that. Because one goes through the chord height, and the ends are at the full radius height. So that the ends are always coming out above. So we found we got to just where the ends would be exactly 3 3/4 inches above the mid strut. Therefore, they would touch each other. Now, this is a very interesting kind of one, because in the tensegrity structure, there is a little springiness of the tension. They are bouncy like that. But I found then all we had to do them absolutely perfectly, and then you would have a hole in the middle of the strut. And we took the struts themselves and scarfed their ends. We had them then go by one another, like this. Brought together and a hole vertically down like this, and that hole came to the exact register with the hole in the mid strut below it, where the two ends came above it. And everything was just where it wanted to be. No, there was nothing in shear. Everything was just where it wanted to be. Because in tensegrity, these parts are really being pulled apart. But we got to where this is exactly where it wants to be mathematically. It doesn't want to be any place in all the universe. Nature always wants to be most economic, she wants to be most comfortable. This is the most comfortable position to be in. So then all we had to do was have one vertical bolt going through those holes and make it fast and everything wanted to be. And I've never seen a domino going together with this. It's one fast thing at the one place it wanted to be, just hold it there. And this took all the, dampened all the springiness, so it made a very firm dome. So next, may I come then? Yeah, you can see the ends being above the meshes. Next picture. So this is that 72-footer, 12 frequency. We bought a telephone pole from the telephone company and used it and hoisted it at the loft as well. And then the university said they're going to have to take it away, so I didn't take my pole out. The pole is not holding it up, obviously. But it was one of the most beautiful domes we ever produced. I'm sorry to say, Southern Illinois University campus plans, architecture planning system, we had to remove it. But it should have stayed there, really, as a permanent building of that campus. The students loved it. They climbed over it a great deal, like little kids would climb in a park, but grown-ups are climbing all over this all the time. I think the university is also afraid they might get hurt. So one reason or another, they forced me to take it down. Next picture. This is the one I said that was quite a famous one. I made those with the deliberately bent parts to go around like that. This is MIT, and I made it with a chain of tubes, and we... This is the very beginning of tensegrity. It's 1950. I was a visiting professor, had the graduate class in architecture for a term. And I put this structure on a landing in the main building of MIT, we come in Massachusetts Avenue, up on the second floor that you can walk up. And a lot of people walk up to the second floor, so I put it right on the landing halfway upstairs. And I assure you, I've never seen anything quite like the MIT professors that saw this and assured they shouldn't be doing what they're doing. They were jumping over, trying to use a trampoline, and it just stood up. And I that year I was asked to speak to the faculty club at MIT. William Worcester was the dean of architecture at MIT that year, and a very fine man, Bill. And later on, he went back to Berkeley, where he'd come from, and he became the dean of the architecture school. And he's the one who changed the name of the architecture school there. And Bill Worcester was a big man, and he'd been asked to do this during World War II, and World War II was just over, And he, at a meeting of the deans of MIT, he said, I see that the faculty club does not think really very well of the architecture department. They think that we're the department of liaison with idiots. Somebody has to talk to the idiots, and then they feel they're all so sane. But he said, we've never been asked to provide the quarterly speaker to the faculty club. And so the other deans admitted they never had, and Bill did have a point, so they asked him then to provide the next quarterly speaker. So Bill found that I was a good, he asked me then to be the quarterly speaker. And I brought that model, I actually made the model for that occasion. And after the luncheon, we put it up on that landing I told you about and had all the consternation in it. And being asked to speak the faculty club, I really don't know how and why I got to doing what I did. Anyway, I said, I'm surprised to be asked to speak to you because you're all so ignorant. And they really all looked very surprised. And I said, I'll just prove it because I showed them that they all knew that the Earth was not the center of the universe, but they were all still seeing the sun go up and down. They were all using words up and down, that had no meaning. I showed them all the things that they were saying that had no meaning. And brought a great laughter, but they knew it really was right. But then I showed them this model of the way they built things, and then they didn't build things in tensegrity at all, and then the universe was doing things in tensegrity, and they were building things absolutely compressional, absolutely no enlightenment at all kind of buildings. I think they would like to prove that this thing didn't work, because I said, they were really coming on it, and really carried the loads in a great way. Next picture. Now, going into there is a central angle strut of a tetrahedron. It's not a regular. It is not a tensegrity, but it has tension around its outside. Next picture. I have that. You know, you make a column of cubes, and you know that in every cube there is a tetrahedron. In fact, there are two tetrahedrons. There's a one diagonal and the other, the red and the blue tetrahedron in each one. Next picture. If I then take only the red tetrahedron in each of the cubes, I'm going to put in make a tensegrity tetrahedron for that. Next picture. This is on its side, not to be able to get it in there, but you can see then, I've used this business of these two can't come together. They've got tension between them. There's tension in the square. So this one then has a pair going that way above it and makes a square section all the way through. So you have tensions along the sides. Then also I found that I didn't have to have these, this didn't touch the other pair because I found that the one above it could be tensionally strung within it, which you'll see the detail of in a minute. Next picture. So it made it possible to make a mass. You can see the two of them. You see the pair going like that, a pair like that, and they're just tension because they are being pulled the other way. So they don't touch each other. Yet they make these central angles of the tetrahedron stretching out of the four to four points, which would be four of the eight corners of the cube. But then the corners of the cube are taken care of by the alternate ones. This one from here takes care of that corner, and the one coming from above takes care of the other corner, so that they get the square of section of each of those cubes. This made my first tensegrity mass. I made one of those down at Black Mountain College, and then Ken got very excited, but this was it. From this point on, Ken himself made some better tensegrity mass. Next picture, please. This is the one I had in the Museum of Modern Art Garden. I think this is the one. Yeah. Next picture. This is another one down in North Carolina State, where it did not have the sling between the two. Next picture. And this one of Ken's really very much simplified. It's a three-sided mast. and he simply continually turbines his members around, going up like that. Next picture. Then I saw that I could take any tensegrity, I could take any geodesic dome, and for every strut I could substitute a tensegrity mast. Then if I looked at that tensegrity mast closely, there was masts in it, there was struts there, so each one of those I could substitute at the very miniature tensegrity mast. Then I get a super microscope and I look at the struts in there and I substitute the tensegrity mast there. I keep that down and finally get down to the size of the atom, this way the atoms are. So absolutely compatible with the atoms. So I saw that, please understand what I say, because the very aluminum I'm using is just tensegrity atomics anyway. That's exactly what alloys are, I gave you the other day. Just critical proximities, and they're simply held in the intention of one another. So that this became very exciting to realize the compatibility and the rate at which you would continually approach, you're doing just what the atom's doing all the time anyway. So tensegrity was, as in pneumatics, you can suddenly see what the molecules are doing. You can see what the atoms are doing, and you're doing what they're doing. Next picture. Then I found you could make a... May I have that back? And then you get a solid matrix going all directions, and using the two pairs of octahedra that way. Next picture. But they don't touch each other, so you can have isotopic vector matrix in tensegrity. This is a picture made in Japan where I made a steel tensegrity, and they were interested in one for a very large, enormous dome for the Olympics, which did not get built, but they went through a very powerful testing on tensegrity. You can see hanging from a joint, looking in those pictures carefully, you see some bags. Those are bags of sand. And they are continually hanging more and more of them on the joints, and they're heavier and heavier. So they have great many bags around that joint. Next picture. This is the board of scientists in Japan. The dome's in the foreground here. Next picture, and the workmen are inside with helmets. They keep adding on more and more of these bags and so forth. Next picture, they had total weight calibrating around the vertexes at all the points of support to see whether it's really distributing its loads even, and it was doing that entirely, and they could get the sum total of weights that were being added in, so what the cumulative weight was, and what they had electric strain gauges on each of the joints, so that we found loads were being absolutely evenly distributed, and we got up to very, very, very high load, way, way over anything was necessary for that particular project. Next picture. This is a Black Mountain where we were doing that one of the 72 footer, and the students were making tests where we then used empty oil barrels and then filling them with water is a very good way. If I know exactly how much you're getting in the loading. And so all of our projects we test, we do not just guess. We make static load tests to be sure that we're not endangering students or the campus and so forth. So it's always had to be out of responsibility as you go. I think that's the is that the end of this set of pictures? There is another one. Right. So, this is a time for a break. It's now 8:15. And keep it as short as you can. The tensegrity then is able to accommodate all the geometry relationships that we now know are part of the great hierarchy of coordination. But apparently by nature in her rational, omnirational manner. There are two, three other tensegrities that we have models of that are very fascinating, that we have students who have made beautiful models of. This incident is that our tetrahedron, this is a that's the 10th segment where we moved out on the wire a little way in the direction towards becoming the octahedron. And there are the positive and the negative octahedrons coming together to make the icosahedron. And this one, a particularly fascinating one, where we have the four planes of the four great circles, all the four planes of the tetrahedron all going through the same common center. So the base triangle of the tetrahedron, each one of these triangles is one of those triangles. This is then a sizeless tetrahedron. Because remember, you have conceptuality independent of size. So here's it is actually volumeless, sizeless tetrahedron. Could not have a better proof of a modeling of a complete abstraction. Now, same then with doing those pentagons, all going through the same common center. In other words, this would be in a sense, the dodecahedron with no volume, all the planes going through the common center. And the 10-segmented cube, which is only cubed by virtue of the triangles in the corner, because the cube would collapse. And when we have the 10-segmented vector equilibrium, it's a very beautiful one. Your squares, your triangles, your six squares, your eight triangles. So, this is a continuous surface. This is a polarized tensegrity, because you've got pentagonal poles here, and you've got triangles, five triangles around, and a set of square sections in the middle. This is a form that I'm going to use for a theater, somewhat modified from this, but the makes it possible being polarized. You have a very, very fine planar condition inside here. In the 10 segments, I think I've told you, then the very little, there'd been no yielding at all in the power of conventional engineering, but the engineering firms that I've had to have to carry through our calculations and agree with other engineers, such as the World's Fair Dome, those engineers understand what it is I am saying, and they agree that the models demonstrate to them tensegrity is really operative, and they agree that they calculate only compressively, and that's all they're allowed to do by the art. And I found the only way I'm going to be able to get them there is by getting pneumatic engineers and hydraulic engineers to make the analysis. And I hope that's going to be some kind of a change around here, but can be that we're also coming into a very new era of humanity, and not only economically and so forth, but in many ways of carrying on, where the validities of such structures as this become really, in the first place, we'll have an orientation where it really is calculatably understood, because we'll realize whether there is hydraulics and pneumatics and there's not the solid continuity. Now, next thing I'd like to point out to you, the nature, remember, in developing a tree and developing our bodies and so forth, doing all of the compression with hydraulics. There's something, other things I've said to you, but I'm going to review and add information in. Historically, man, then, over incredible periods of time, had rock readily at hand, and he found if he piled the rock up, he could get his walls, his vertical walls, but gravity held them together, gave them a stability. And then he did his horizontals in woods, we have then, in that long period of time, compression of the ultimate strength of the masonry around 50,000 pounds to the square inch, and the tensile strength of said mortar about 50 pounds, so that 50,000 versus 50, so we have 1,000 times greater compressive capability than we had tensive capability from the Stone Age viewpoint, and that has really that carried through architecture right up the time after World War I, when I was building my first buildings and running in the building departments. And as far as engineering goes, they're really carrying on in that compressive continuity. Wood, many different types of wood, I've said, had different tensile strengths, and the aircraft wings that were covered by the English by birch did get up some swatches at 25,000, but 5,000 is usually a very good. If you can get to 5,000 tensile with the fir and so forth, you're doing quite well. So 5,000 versus 50 pounds, or 100 times, wood was running 100 times stronger in tension than the masonry. But historically then, for just make a chart, for millions of years, man has compressive superiority to his tension. 50,000 compression in the best wood, 5,000, so that he had 100-fold greater compressive strength. I take this really very... It is very indicative of his philosophy and of the power structure idea that there's a muscle that could ultimately take compression as muscle, you just push and push. It's a very male phenomenon. And so when we have then man discovering that stone, if it was cracked up, certain kinds of stone had metals in them and could be melted out, and these metals then had very much higher, it had equal compressive strength, but very much higher tensile strength than the rock. In fact, the tensile strength usually went up to just about the same as the compressive strength. This is what made tin very important. I'm going to talk more about tin later on. But we have in the Roman Empire then this compressive stone masonry, and you had a great deal of ceramics, crockery, and so forth, and had a little bit of steel for your swords and things like that, a little amount of metals for armory, but it was certainly very great importance. The tin was very low melting point, and it could cohere metals with considerable tension, and very much better than anything you could do in masonry, and therefore you could really put together all kinds of special arrangements with soldering, and you could make utensils, mixing the lead and tin and other things, making pewter. Thought about some very nice instruments and tools, and this made then the Caesar go all the way to England, where the great tin load had been found. Tin had been brought to by the Phoenicians. Incidentally, the oldest known records of any metal in all the history of all the different countries is a record of tin, because the Phoenicians kept such beautiful records of the tin traffic to England, the Mediterranean. So that they brought enough tin by water to make the English find it worthwhile building highway all the way, great stone highway right across from Italy to Europe and crossing over in England and then occupy England. This, you can see that just a little up in tensile capability did this. Then we finally get to men developing better and more metals, and they get into various musical strings and make special little alloys worth the doing, and we finally get to Roebling building the Brooklyn Bridge. There had been chain bridges I mentioned to you earlier, where you've got chain links and big steel, like the chain links you find in a bicycle, see, but an enormous size. You can still see a lot of those in Europe. And then finally, Roebling, using piano steel wire, built Brooklyn Bridge. We have, up to this time then, mild steel of a tensile strength of about 50,000 pounds comes into production in the middle of the 19th century, time of the Civil War, 1851, we have production steel. And 50,000 tensile and 50,000 compression, and the stone had 50,000 compression, so we have, suddenly tension came to parity with compression at the time of the Civil War. I say, there's one reason why a Benjamin, Abraham Lincoln could be saying. It could be that right is coming to sensei over might, the right being what mind knows how to do with principles. This is just this muscle. And along at that time also came the first dynamos and the electric power, so that those both motivated Lincoln very, very much. And Lincoln suddenly was wired, as I said to you the other day, by telegraph to his front seat. Very new era of a new kind of capability, Mendelian metals. But significant, I made a great big chart historically, compressiveness 50,000 versus 7,000 tension for millions of years, and suddenly in the middle of the 19th century changing that up to parity for tension and compression. From that time on, with Roebling getting into 70,000 tensile and the stone column of the mass of his bridge, same old 50,000, so tension began to be of higher capability than the compression. Then we get in World War I, aircraft steel, chrome aluminum steel, getting up to 110,000. World War II saw us getting to 350,000 in stainless steel, 350,000 compressive tension strength. No improvement in compression. Since World War II, we've gotten a great many laboratory advances in tension, where in some iron crystals, hairs, whisker crystals, and in some aluminum sapphire crystals, and some glass, and some beryllium, we've all reached 1,000,000 pounds of square inch tensile strength. And we find that, and now we get the boron going up to even 5 million. Boron 5 is laid in parallel, doing very extraordinary strength, very special tasks. Incidentally, in the yacht racing world, the 12-meter boats and so forth, where very large amounts of money go in, many of these high capabilities of high tensile strength makes a greater difference in rigging of a ship like that. This is the only place where they really get a workout. They do get into the rocketry, but I think it's very worthwhile everybody knowing that the racing sailing world does provide quite a laboratory. And just as I say, the space program is taking care of what do you need, what does a human being really need, and develop the right environment and all the things, maintain life. Same way, I find that yachting world and tending to have how to concentrate to get get lighter and lighter boats. Kilometers per pound is the very, very essence. You don't want weights in the engine buildings of your boat. It'll porpoise up and down like that rock if it has too much weight in the end. Must weight speed, etc. Cut down the weights every way they can on the cooking equipment and on the. So you get people have a high standard of living. They like to live comfortably, and yet they want to really tackle that sea, and that sea is a rough place. They have to do things so they have great strength and all kinds of awkwardness position. And we're developing very, very good solutions to living problems on boats and also in the mobile homes and so forth. There's very great deal going on where you have to have high performance per pound. Now, I was mainly wanting you to look at a very big major thing, which was the compression dominating for millions of years, and just a century ago changing abruptly to tension coming to parity, and in our own century where tension goes way into excessive capability in contradistinction to compression. Now, just getting excess tension capability really is not enough, because to really have advantage, you need to have both in balance, because nature is, structuring is in tension compression. It is a fundamental complementarity. So I said nature herself, then building you, our bodies, and building trees and so forth, then uses tension, does all of the tension with crystalline, because they have triple bonds, they have the greatest possible coherence. But she does all of her compression with liquids and gases. Gases for the shock loads, because they're highly compressible. The liquids are absolutely non-compressible. We get into hydraulic rams and jacks. You can get up to lifting enormous buildings. There's absolutely, as far as we know, no limit of compressive strength of liquids. And that's pretty saying quite a lot. They probably are, but we do not know what they are yet. So that I expect in the new era of tensegrity to have the tensions done by these beautiful alloys where we get down to incredibly delicate members. But the compression will be done as nature does it, with the locally available liquids and gases. She only ships the tension package because there's always locally available the liquids and the gases. So that I say then, I've got into a lot of studies of liquid components, and then did get into making liquid columns quite a long time ago, and finding once you put your load on the liquid, it just throws all the metal in absolute tension. That's where it's really good, and there's no buckling effects whatsoever. So that when we get to that, we're going to get to something very important. It's very easy to have non-freezing liquids. That's easy to accomplish, already well done. And so that I expect to see the next era, really, of a really important building, high tensegrity structures with the hydraulic compression and pneumatic load. I told you this, only time man ever used that very good design was in the landing gear of the great airplanes. He couldn't handle the problem if he hadn't gone to nature's really best way of doing things. Now, in the space world and in the weaponry world, I went through the factory of Smith & Wesson, the largest firearms producers in Springfield, just outside Springfield, Enfield. And the delicate structures that are made for controlling mechanisms and have to be very reliable, so they're forgings. Forging, you can take a metal, if you really forge it, really press those atoms closer together, the critical proximities then bring about enormous strength. So forgings are essential to really great strength. And forging is quite expensive equipment. Now, and forging capabilities, I saw, producing all the little mechanisms of the valves and so forth, incredible things. So it is very easy to make valves that are absolutely tight hydraulically if you do the right forging and so forth. So I expect to see the solution of the hydraulic, where we use it, the local liquids, the valvings of the liquids and so forth, which have to be done, to be done in very, very delicate, very powerful ways. All this means then, if we do get over the nonsense of spending all of our wealth to getting ready for the next war, and we really use that capability to produce the right structural components. If I had available to me what I saw in Smith & Wesson, I proposed to Smith & Wesson, they really considered very seriously what I'm talking about. They've really got in the livingry versus their weaponry. They might find themselves a very much greater problem still, and not with all the anathema that goes with being weapons manufacturers, because they're not really enjoying that feeling of society about them. Anyway, I'm hoping I'm giving you some little insights in the way I think things are going to endure, refine hardware, but always hydraulic compression, and the metal is just really fundamental in tension. This is going to mean my estimates indicate we might get into where I give you 500 buildings for one. And the kind of strengths we can have, the very, very practical matter to literally fire a building in a very, very compact way into place and just exploding over it, and there you are. These things are highly, highly feasible. I got into a great deal of this in the space program and in the advanced structures research team that I was on, where we found a perfectly practical matter out in space to make very large assemblies where they don't have gravitational problems. And you could really make two-mile diameter domes. And they then can let down in the atmosphere with so relatively light they act like a ping pong ball in the Niagara Falls. Nothing happens to them. They really tend to let down very quietly and be able to then support the gravity, be able to take very complex buildings and assemble them in space and just put them situated under that. Absolutely confident this is going to come out out of the space program and developing then the living in space, which Russia and the United States are doing. We're going to get cooperating about that. It's going to be very, very important. They are doing so, thank goodness, and out of that that kind of extension of living anywhere in the universe will come enormous capability on right on board of our planet. Attitudes will change very rapidly. All right? Big curve of history, compassion and dominance, then suddenly tension coming in, being up. Now, talking about a different kind of a compassion instead of a hard, non-load distributing compassion of the stone. We're talking about beautiful load distributing compassion capability. It's a very different kind of compassion capability. It's a very tolerant kind of capability. It takes relatively low pressures to take care of large sats, as you find with big automobile truck tires. It can be relatively low pressure because the loads are distributed. Now, I find these highly philosophically informative, and they're historically informative, and they're predictive capabilities I talked to you about. And I see, man, that all the things that I've seen that I've developed that have been used by society have always come in an emergency. Society only takes on the new when nothing else will work, because all the people have been prospering by and profiting, exploiting older ways, will not yield until the situation one way what they're doing will not work, and then suddenly the new comes in. So I think the things that you're going over with me here in this session are going to be very informative to you, and you will not be surprised that many of the things are suddenly going to be happening. You'll be attuned for and have yourself organized to expect these things, and I find you will not tend to oppose our own salvation is continually emerging here. Now, this is a beautiful, incredible task that the World Gaming Seminar, the World Game Study Group, did this last year here in Pennsylvania. On the energy report, and on that energy report, as I told you, they've been able then, as the same kind of thorough competence demonstrated in the first studies about whether it is really possible to go to the moon, what are all the things that have to be done, what should the first things be done, and what are all the contingencies in supply, resources, capabilities, proven capabilities. They've been able then to develop this report, which does show incontrovertibly, absolutely, the words incontrovertibly, that it is highly feasible to take care of all of humanity's energy requirements at a very high level of energy requirement by 1985 while completely phasing out all fossil fuels and all atomic energy. This, however, is their work was done on the basis of the kind of energy use that the level of energy use has been going on in the United States, making some allowance for some improvement. But as I already pointed out to you, out of every 100 barrels of petroleum, we are in effect letting 95 go down the flush. We're only getting 5% out of the potential. And I know how it's highly feasible to get the magnitudes up very rapidly. So I think that I hope that one of the next projects to be tackled by the seminar here, and which now has really re-earned the right to use the words world game. I didn't want world game used until they really were using design science competence. But they did do that in this energy report. So that the next seminar, I hope that they're going to have one of the projects to be done will be the much more efficient energy uses, the feasibility now known ways of employing energies more effectively. But I've got to point out to you very powerfully and emphasize, I've already mentioned this to some extent, that every time you double the size of the geometrical object, you increase its surface by 4 and its volume by 8. Therefore, every time you double the size of a dome, you halve the amount of surface, the imposing surface, which an interior molecule of atmosphere can gain or lose heat. So the efficiency go up very, very rapidly. And there are then these aerodynamics of the buildings where I found that there's the windmill idea, but the windmill is only good for the total area of the, swept out by the windmill. I find that whole buildings occupying enormous areas, and any gases, atmosphere that are intercepted in their motion as wind by any kind of an obstacle, that the total frontal area is what counts. And I found it highly feasible to use the whole of a building, that total frontal area, and to, by proper designing of the building, to streamline the low pressure which develops from the passing of... Why do you have a low pressure? Let's get into that fairly quickly. We have a penetrating medium and a penetrating body. I want you to think about the wing foil used by the Wright brothers. As this wing foil then addresses the air has to be opened up to go over this side and goes this side. The air then closes together finally, but it's a greater distance to go over the top of the wing than it is on the flat of the wing. Therefore, the same amount of air has to go greater distance. Therefore, it has to be pulled thinner. And it's the pulling of it thinner that gives a negative pressure on the top. It's a very, very important thing. There is a certain amount of planing effect, like having a plane on the water or the air below. But the water, air is so compressible, that is relatively negligible. It's only 25% of the effect of the lift. 75% is on the top of the wing in the negative pressure. So, when you begin to understand your aerodynamics like that, then I find it's highly feasible, and then with the structure we built, they call the Fuller House of the Beach Aircraft in 1944-45, to then take all the air motion coming by that building and focus it at one point in the upper lee side, and by having a great ventilator move around so that the tail of the ventilator, which is open 28 square feet of opening, coincide where the low pressure occurred, and low pressure then pulled air, and we had then the ventilator leading to a great cylinder down through the house and open to the bottom, so they pulled air through the building. So the total intercepted air pulled a great enormous vacuum to pull air through a shaft, and the air going through there at such a velocity could really get in the high turbines. All the windmills that are now producing are then designed in the terms of average wind speeds. They have to be designed in the terms of the average condition. We really want to have them working fairly regularly. Therefore, the average wind speeds are really quite low. But every once in a while, in this place, you get very much higher winds. And all the windmills are designed for these average wind speeds are designed at such proportional that when you get to a hurricane, if you get up to over 30 miles an hour, they have to shut them down. They furl them. The Greek windmills have these spars going out like that, and then they have sails coming from them to back to the next spar before. And they have furlability. This triangular fabric sail then can be rolled up by the spar, so that they can cut down the amount of windage as the winds get heavy. And then they finally get where they've got to be completely furled, because the hub would come apart, the structure won't take it. There's a design for fair weather, and nobody's has any windmills that in any way take advantage of the very high winds, over 30. And the place where an enormous amount of very high wind, never been taken advantage of. But that can be taken advantage of by the building I gave you, and then getting into the kind of turbine wheels, very high speeds, that we have in the steam engine, the steam turbines, and so very beautiful blades turning very, very fast. Be very, very practical matter. Anyway, I'm quite confident we're going to get in very much better wind harnessing. And so I'm thinking about then the aerodynamics of buildings, both of the heat losses and gains, that kind of business, due to relative size, and how then the bigger the building, the more we're going to low pressure build up more and more of a low pressure. If you take next time you're out with an umbrella and it's blowing, take a hold of the umbrella quite high up in the stalk, just below the spokes, and hold it sort of gimbaled in your fingers, and you find as the wind blows, it wants to head right over in the wind. That is simply because, the underpower of that umbrella is flat, and the top is this, so that it builds a low pressure in the top, and builds a low pressure just about back to the back end of the umbrella, which pulls it forward, and this, it rotates in your hand, so it goes vertically. I just wanted to just feel this thing. So we begin to get bigger and bigger buildings, so they're going to conserve the energy better and better. Then we're going to get larger and larger interference with the winds, and can have much more. We get where those very big buildings really take care of a whole city. We'd have such an air pull, and all you have to do is have as I had on the beach aircraft house, that enormous rotating cone up at the top with its tail on it, which we've came to by tests and wind tunnels. So we finally got the least drag, or the least wasteful resistance, but really focus the low pressure in the best way. And this is that form. So this thing rotates around and is always at the point where you need it to pull. And it'd be very easy to have these on a dome cover a whole city. So the heat conservation is very, very great. I'm going to come to first the studies I made with geodesic domes, theoretical studies, because I'd found that I was entitled to think about any size span due to being tensegrity. I then got into calculating larger and larger domes. What were the actual logistics? What would be the size of the members and so forth? What would be the strategy of getting a very large building into place? I finally got up calculations of a 2-mile diameter geodesic dome. And I found that it was really practical matter to do so, and I planned then how the component areas, large assemblies, would be put together on the ground, and then helicopter lifted complex assemblies and fastened into the hull. And this dome then came out 2 miles in diameter, and because I had calculated it, I wondered what it would look like in relation to something I was familiar with. Now, it turned out that the Manhattan Island is just 2 miles wide at 42nd Street. So here was a 2-mile diameter dome, and I then got this aerial photograph of lower Manhattan, and up at the, if you look at this, you see that dome there, and just on its left edge up there you see the Hudson River. If you can remove me again, be a good idea, for the picture, going from the tip of Manhattan down here on the lower left-hand side, and going up the Hudson River on the top, and they have the East River on the right, looking down over Brooklyn, and Brooklyn Bridge is in the lower, and the Manhattan Bridge. So going up the Hudson River to where the dome comes, you'll see those are great docks, and actually, just to get under the dome, at the dock is the Queen Mary. Now, it happened that the size of the compression members on this dome were the diameter of this mass of the Queen Mary. And I found that you can see, if you were to see the original of this photograph, you can see the stacks of the Queen Mary, which are considerable diameter, but you can't see her mass from this altitude. Therefore, you could not see my compression members in the dome from this altitude. Therefore, it really like looking at a aluminum kitchen sieve from a great distance, where you wouldn't be able to see the individual wires. You just see a glistening wires or reflectivity of the aluminum. So that's what we have here. So an airbrush of this was perfectly valid, but you couldn't see any compression members. Now, I found that it went between 22nd Street and 62nd Street, and under that dome, in the very middle of it there, you can see the Empire State Building. And it was then, as you know, quite a high building, but it is only a quarter of a mile high, and this is a 2-mile diameter dome, so that it's a mile high, so the Empire State Building really just very small altitude underneath that dome. Having then actually gone through my calculations and found it was feasible, and the amount of material, incidentally, to produce a dome was just about the same as the amount of the metal in the Queen Mary. So that again seemed to give a sense of a reasonable magnitude. And then I found that because I've spent a great deal of my life in New York. I was very familiar with it. I got a New York maps, and I was able then to identify for each block the size of the buildings. We have maps showing that are on each of those blocks at the present time. I calculated the surface of all the buildings and the area underneath that dome. When I got to the little brownstone, that was an average, so you could get those quite fast. So that I only had to really calculate the main big buildings in order to get it quite rapidly. I found that the surface of the buildings standing below my dome was 80 times the surface of the dome itself. Now, if you want to have a good air-cooled engine, you usually put fins on it, series of fins, because what you need is a lot of metal. Metal is your energy heat, a conductor's heat, and you want to have the most cross-section of metal from the source of the heat out to the air, and the greatest amount of surface of the metal to get rid of it in the air. So the more surface you have per cross-section of the fin, the more rapidly you get rid of it. If you'd like to have a really good air-cooled engine, you do what nature does. You find that the tropics, that she has enormous great leaves, banana leaves, some of these get incredibly large. But as she gets further and further north, where the season is shorter, and she goes up the hill where it gets colder and colder, she needs to get the most possible energy intake. She makes needles instead of leaves, because the amount of surface exposed to the cross-section that conducts it inwardly is greater than the needles. So if you'd like to have the best air-cooled engine, would be spikes. But the spikes would be very uncomfortable on motorcycles. So they're not built that way. But that would give you the best. Now, if you want to see the best air-cooled engine in the world, look at New York City. These spikes going up there, and I found them. These spikes, the surface of the spikes was 84 times the surface of the cowling that went over it. So just such a cowling would reduce the heat losses in New York 80-fold. I say 80-fold. That's not what I'm talking about, a reduction. Then we found that the dome then conserves that energy. If it's a big one, then the loss through the skin is very, very low, so that it's very powerful. Just practically the heat of the people and so forth would practically heat New York. We'd not have to put this incredible energy in there. We're continually losing energy at New York because the air cooling, the heating and the cooling in the summer, the same thing. The surface is continually losing it out there. Long, long ago, we began to measure the temperature of the East River and the Hudson River in contradistinction to the water up in the New York in Long Island Sound or out in the ocean there, and the temperatures just of the utilities so forth using the water ran the temperature up 10 degrees above the surrounding, and so the environment of New York is it gets well no snows. It does get red snows in there, but a good deal of time, these big cities, the snow gets melted before it can come in as it does in the country. That's due to the enormous heat losses. So I'm now getting out that there are incredible number of ways of conserving the energy that we do use. And there's no question about the kind of harvesting. They've already proven that, and in the reports now already out. But I'd like to show that I'll give you my estimate right now that we could reduce the energy uses. I think very readily over 50% of our general energy uses. And I'm going to also come to other parts of coming back to remember my grand strategy of developing artifacts instead of political reforms and so on, instead of some kind of new accounting system, and getting rid of this down to the artifacts imposed there, the new accounting. I'm going to give you, and I have it Xerox for all of you, and I'm still working on the last cleanup of it, pieces I've written and rewritten for years and years. I've possibly rewritten it several hundred times now, called What I'm Trying to Do. And it'll be about 5,000 words now. And I'm going to give you Xeroxes of that. And gets into the artifacts and the, what I think to be the most pertinent factor of the things we can do. But what I see is that along with power structure, dividing to keep conquered, and keeping all the specialization going, and keeping people busy so they won't make mischief, get into mischief, we find them inventing all kinds of jobs. Now, the fact is that what we need, I'd like to get down to what is wealth. And to me, wealth is the organized capability of society to employ its resources and know-how, the organized capability of doing so, to take care of how many lives for how many days. That is the measure of how much wealth you have. You have to use the principles, you've got things organized. So after we stop all input right now, could be able to take care of 100 million people for 2 weeks, whatever it is. That would be the real measure to me. Their wealth also then would also have to do with the accommodation of man's proclivities to gain information, to move from here to there, to do his work, to do whatever he needs to do. So there's an accommodation of the volitions and the freedoms to get the information he needs in order to serve his fellow man, and they taking care of the life support itself. These are wealth. Any job that man does that does not produce wealth, which includes that degrees of freedom, accommodation of man's needs, accommodation of the fact that he does have legs and he is a mobile and that he has incredible need for information. So that's producing wealth, you're getting information. But I find then at the present time, about 90% of all the jobs that are being done are not producing wealth. They are invented jobs. And this, to understand what I'm saying requires my going into quite a little of an account of economics, and I'm going to do that with you today now. But mainly in view of the fact that these are not producing wealth, I can see that one of the most important things for us to do is to stop having people go to work using up gasoline, when we get down to the cosmic accounting, I went into that with you, it costs nature $1 million to make a gallon of petroleum. Well, we now have then people spending $3 and $4 million a day to go to work to earn something called $50 or something like that. This is not making any sense whatsoever. So I certainly would see that we would be giving fellowships to do whatever you need to do to get your information. But this doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to be moving around all the time. When you do need to move around, you must accommodate it. That will be helping to produce the wealth. But when much of the time you really need to be stay in one place doing all kinds of experimental work, doing all kinds of reading and studying. So that I think that the minute society gets over nonsense of the power structure, dividing and conquering, making specialists, really that society say, do just what you did when you're born, they're going to look out for you. We used to say, well, look out for you. I did this before up to 6, and then they said, look out for you through high school, and then now we looked out for you through PhD. Then you have to earn a living in a hurry, and then make you retire. And retirement, incidentally, was invented by the insurance companies, assuming they'd never really have to lose any money. They'd had retirement funds, and when I was born, life expectancy for a male in the United States was 42 years of age. And again, out of this World War I, having to finance and back medicine in order not to have to repair the people instead of trying to send new people there, being much less expensive, suddenly health began to improve, and so that people used to die stopped dying. And in the 20s and 30s, extraordinary new changes had occurred. So that now life expectancy for males had gone up to 68, for females up to 72. Almost doubled in my lifetime. So retirement was set when I was young at at 45 to 50, because 42 is the average. Nobody's going to get live to this, and the insurance company is pretty sure they never have to pay out those funds. It's a great money-making idea. And now we've gotten to a point where people are retiring, having to retire 20 years before they're through at all, and probably the most important kind of years. So you don't, we'll take care of you through a PhD, and then for 15 years you really got to just do that. But I'm going to cut out that nonsense. And it's going to cut itself out too, because last year it's really quite a formidable figure. I think that the number of PhDs in physics, I was given this figure out in California just 3 weeks ago. I think it was 9,000 PhDs in physics last year, and only 2,000 had their jobs. And this is, it's utterly specialized. So I say evolution working in very, very big ways. And anyway, nothing could be more logical than this. Somebody give you a fellowship all the way through to stop this nonsense. And nothing but yielding to the conditioned reflexes about, now, you could be a busy boy here. Mind me. So I began to really look into these sum total of all the ways in which we can conserve energy. I'm quite confident we could within, by the same 1985, we might really see all humanity enjoying very much more wealth, very much more freedom than it's ever even dreamt it had. And by 85, and be using maybe one quarter amount of energy. I think we're going to be very energy rich. The very report that you've done, showing that we can do the energy side, we're going to get where the thinker can really think of very extravagant things to do with energy to improve man's advantage and to increase his local searching in the universe, participation in local universe in very big ways. I can see all these things really coming. I want you to feel it along with me. I said I was going to go into a review of some economic phenomena that have brought about our habits, the way of looking at things, the kind of counting system we have. I want you to think, going back again to naked man, and like a big man being born, didn't ask to be born bigger, but then 5 years and then being inducted, as everybody wants to do the fighting for them and so forth. In the same kind of way, I also had people coming off the sea and getting out, gradually training the animals and going off with their flocks into the great wilderness of the enormous Eurasian continent, working far more or less after the sun, getting caught in all kinds of mountains and valleys and deserts, getting isolated and developing into hundreds of separate nations with thousands of years of inbreeding. Of those who were the ones who survived under those special conditions. So, thinking about that, those people going off following their sheep, for instance. And there were also some people that learned how to train to take these wild horses and get them trained. So, these people are off with their sheep, and they've been off doing this for 5, 10, 100 generations, maybe. Suddenly, a tiger appears on the horizon with a horse, and he's got some very valuable sheep here. I said, they're all right. And I said, it's kind of dangerous to have all this sheep out here in the wilderness. Somebody's going to take it. Well, so we've been getting on for 1,000 years and no trouble at all. So I think it's very dangerous if you have it. So the man disappears, and during the night, a great many sheep disappear. Man comes around and says, "Boy, that's awful. You've lost all those sheep got killed last night. I told you really need some protection." So, after that's gone on, finally the poor shepherd and the chieftain said, "All right, we need protection." So there turned out to be a number of these characters on horses that find that they can really overpower people on foot. And they begin to, let's say, which is my territory? So these land-claiming barons then begin to claim enormous amounts of the wilderness and say, "This is mine," and then they get in their own battles to see who's going to be the dominant. But they're simply, and they're giving protection. So suddenly there really is a dividing up of this, and then they got to where the man, now it's acknowledged that he is the land baron, and he comes around and extracts various kinds of tributes for his protection. And this gets you into negotiations of human beings, and he begins to have more and more power over their dealings. The same kind of way we had people caravanning or voyaging, carrying resources of great value from here to there, and particularly over the land, the coming over trails. So there's certain trails that are obviously very much more the only way you could get from here to there. You have to go those trails. The place where trails come together, and people's coming together, and trails from very remote places found, boy, you've got some great stuff there. And he said, yeah, you've got some great stuff. So they're going to be trading, because these goods complement one another. And so that these men are trading there, and they've been doing this for maybe 200-300 years, and suddenly one of those big carriages with a horse, and I said, oh, you people got some very valuable stuff out here, it's completely unprotected. And you better not do that, and so forth, and things happen to all the things, so gradually the people yield, all right, we need protection. So immediately the power structure builds a wall around the fighting area. And all his henchmen then have sections, they own different parts of it, but is in now in this big trap they got. So everything has to go on inside the gates, and all the trading must go on inside there. Then they find that the enormous numbers of people who have realized their wealth, have their great tales going on, so the farm boys and the people of the wilderness try to get that city, get in that wealth. And they get there, and they're absolutely stranded because there's no way they can produce wealth and life support. The only thing they can do is then work under there's a lot of wealth in that city, but they're not allowed to get at it. So they're allowed to do jobs. So they're highly exploitable at incredibly low figures as craftsmen. So things are integrated into goods, and they're woven and so forth. So the people do all this working are doing it for almost nothing, just starvation by it all the time. Completely victimized by this enclosure they have here. This is when we talk about cities, this is the way cities begin. This is a city. They're all walled, and it's going a little further than what I gave you as the city-state. It's a different kind. It's now a commercial kind of a city. In the same way, the people who control the land then began to control all the cattle that lay within in their lands. And they began to be able to, they did all kinds of trading. This is where they then began to do trading where they, the first place the land baron says this, heard it, so you know, you've got to buy your range. No such thing as freelance, just how this nonsense. This is a range, and you're going to have to buy it. And the herder said, I don't have that kind of money. So he said, I loan you the money, and you pay on time here. And the way you pay is with cattle. Payment in kind is the expression. It goes back in Sartre. And then they got to be trading with, this is the way cattle got to be money. Cattle got to be money all over the world, and it still is only really very visible in Africa, and particularly Central Africa, Middle Africa, Burundi and those places. But it's still very powerful there. And I've been in the countries where they're using it that way. And I also explained to you that when the great capital adventures began to occur, like going off into ships, the people who then the land barons, some of them then really, there were people who had ideas, and the land baron didn't really want to go off that voyage himself, so somebody said, I know how to build a ship, and I'd like to build a ship, I'd like to have this big venture, and so the land barons are allowed to go on the venture with you, and so forth. But these two land barons got together, so you'll have to put up some collateral with me. So they put up their cattle as collateral to cover their half of their part of the venture. And because cattle have kind, or kin, or child, then it got to be expected that whoever was doing the loaning was entitled to the young. Okay, you pay back the same number of head. This is where the idea of interest came from. Don't you realize that this interest had an absolute basic fundamental way? It was something really nature did for them. There was synergetic effect going on there. When we get to the point that I mentioned this to you before, they're carrying cattle in their ships. We get to Crete, the bull people, because they're carrying the cattle in their ships for the money. It'll be known that way. The Vikings carried it for a while. That's why they had the horns on them. But they finally, the Venetians, the first to realize, they began to voyage very much further, and they just found it a very impractical matter to take the cattle with them because they had to feed them too much. So they got into the idea of money. Money was invented about 2000 BC, in the Asia Minor. And from there on, when you're using this metallic money, obviously it didn't have little metallic money, but they kept up with the idea of the interest. So this meant then whatever your capital value was, you literally were cutting it down by paying the interest. You didn't lose your number of cows before, but suddenly you're really cutting down your capital. It didn't cut down your capital before, but it really was a very devastating thing. So if you're using money as your principal and you're paying interest, more people are eating off the same amount of life support. That's what you're talking about. Therefore, the individual shares go down. So immediately depreciates the value of the money. And money has been continually depreciating as long as the interest. So that it isn't really a matter of we keep talking about the escalation of the prices. What's really been going on is depreciation of our individual equities. Now, I've given you a fairly good insight into the beginnings of merchant trafficking and accountings. And incidentally, it's very interesting to note that as the Phoenicians then began not just to trade in cattle, just to trade in, they began to meet people of all kinds of languages around the world. And they began to get actually into contracts, written contracts and so on. They had to have some meaning to the words that were going on. This brought about the Phoenicians realizing that they could codify the sounds of the speech. It brought about the phonetics, or the letters that represented the way you sound the things. This brought about a very new era, and did make it possible for them to trade and to make contracts and know what the other man is saying. Ezra Pound, the writer, pointed out that he was a great expert in ideographs and the Chinese language of characters and so forth, where they dealt really synergetically. As for instance, you could not say that the color, communicate the color red, write about it. But what you could show was an apple and a flamingo and various things, and there was something generalizable, which was, there was something in common, which was red. And that's the way they communicated it. And it really caused human beings to do a lot of thinking. It was thought stimulating, the whole of that ideographic world. And Ezra Pound says that when the Phoenicians suddenly then got down to fractionation, even a word itself into its own letters, you went right the opposite way from the comprehensive down to such special parts. He then identifies, very properly, the Tower of Babel with the development of the Phoenician language, spelling. This is when things really began to come apart, and where people became much more myopic than they had been. Well, I'm not going to jump historically, carrying forward the idea of the land very powerfully. And as you realize, up right well into the 19th century, great land ownership with a great importance all through Europe and around the world. There's enormous, really, in China, autonomous land barons, and Europe and England, places like that, get very powerful, but more or less united landowners, great landowners, and earning great wealth from their lands, and having sharecroppers and so forth, and having the ticing barn, whereas when the crops came in, then they everything had to be exchanged, and then certain great shares had to go to the landowner. We have the American Revolution coming after people left Europe for various kind of reasons, but very, very prominently leaving England, Europe for religious reasons, and particularly those who did come from England. I want to point out to you also that England is often thought of erroneously as a nation, but those British Isles were overrun time and again. The Angles and Jutes, it'd be very hard to find any Angle and Jute blood there, I'm sure. It is overrun and overrun by the people who wanted to control those unsinkable flagships that commanded those harbors. So there's the Vikings or the somebody's powering in there all the time. And what we call English language should not be called English language, should really be called people's language, because it is everything. It's Sanskrit, it's Old German, it's everything. Danish, the works. And these are things I think is very important to straighten ourselves out on. So when we're looking for a world language, this is a place where Salem and all of the places more or less found sounds that get on pretty well anywhere around the world. It's already very much a world language. And it goes along with maybe there's theoretically better ways of making up a word, but it goes along with the alliteration, the way the tongue tends to behave, and these things are, there were a lot of people that couldn't say, and we get some of the Icelanders can say this very well. They've got in German they can't say Vater, and say Father. And you got the D's and the B's, all kinds of interchanges of this kind. But what is called English language pretty well, sort of a tested way of how almost anybody can say it, and should be thought that way. At any rate, England then was this great crossbreeding of many people coming there, and yet there were these great powerful landowners, enormous. And they don't really get shaken until World War I. But we have the great battle between when the Romans did get to the British Isles, the battles between a protesting people who don't quite agree with the Roman Church, and then all those long battles between England and Rome. This affects all those Isles in Europe in general, and there were language. The religious fanaticism was such that the people who escaped from England to America, coming in ships, the voyaging of that time was incredibly dangerous. To risk it was an extraordinary thing. You had to really care an awful lot to take that kind of a chance. And just think of just what happened while the king gave great landowners in England enormous tracts in America, and they were very eager to have people go there to exploit it, to get something getting going, so they earned something out of it. The earliest voyages to America are not published at all. I've looked into those a lot, but I've spent a lot of my life in Maine, and the first people who came in around 1604 and 1603 and so forth, and they came to the places like Head Tide up in Wiscasset and so forth, and they were massacred, right? Time and again they came in those colonies just massacred, so this is such bad news the landowners didn't want the people in England to know about it. So we don't get any really things sticking. The Pilgrims and Plymouth colony gets to be known as the 1620, considerably later, when it was not, they were not massacred, but they, that living was so bad, as you may go back in that kind of gun, but the percentage that died that first year, that first winter, is incredible. Coming, this was something to go into. The people who then came with very deep convictions of their philosophic needs, and it was a very powerful kind of individual gamble, stronger gamble. So there was a colonizing of America, not really out of an average kind of a attitude of just yielding and so forth. It was powerfully founded. So the crossbreeding of that probably was pretty strong, and probably accounts for the really oftentimes very obstreperous sort of independence of something goes on in this continent. At any rate, America is anything but a nation. It is just an incredible mixture of all people from all around the world. And it's not a nation at all, but it's the beginning of a very larger increment of world man. Now, the people who then came, the great landowners wanted people to come, and in the South had worked well and had slaves. But the North is really was very much more this religious group, puritanical. And by and large, and we get to the point where they would not tolerate what's going on in England and the taxing that was going on of them. So the landowners beginning to impose on them in the name of the king. So we find the revolution taking place. And with the revolution over, we have in the power in the Congress Alexander Hamilton arguing, and finally, effectively, with the Congress, that it was not the intent of the signers of the Declaration and the those who supported the Revolution that the American government should have any money or capital capability. It had no wealth. It was just a sort of a service organization of convenience. And it was then Alexander Hamilton then persuaded the Congress and so on to get an interpretation. And the interpretation then said that the government would then have expenses, obviously, things it had to do, but it then would have to borrow the money from the banks of the landowners and then pay, tax the people and pay the money back to the banks with interest. Now, that's a relatively short time ago, finally, the majority persuading the Congress that's the way it has to be. So we get to a point where there was a game going on where wealth was something absolutely invisible that belonged to very powerful people. And the land was all they needed to show. They had enormous tracts of land. And the deeds. And the deeds themselves went back to a king granting the deed, and the deeds of the king, goes to somebody with a sword, somebody saying, I claim this in the name of my king. Does anybody say no? Anybody say no? Okay, right out of the deeds. So, there's nothing actually in any moral judgment or any really philosophical deliberation about how this came about. It's just absolutely a power phenomenon. So we have then the wealth, and I really grew up in this kind of an atmosphere where wealth was something absolutely incredible. You didn't really have to say, if you had it, you really got it. And these great landowners simply had it. And so it was a poker game in which they never had to show their hands. So we have World War One, and World War One then was because the great masters of that water ocean world found themselves, their line of supply being attacked by the enemy, the out pirates, went after the in pirates only guarding the surface of Earth, I gave you this before, they went underwater and above the water, and they broke the line of supply. And they were going to lose if America's great productivity was not brought in. Finally, they did persuade America to come in. I was part of the young people at that time, and the propaganda we received was very, very effective. And I was really, as a young man, was being persuaded that democracy has enormous at stake, and I really believed democracy is just great. And so the Wilson thing was to save democracy. We went in. Well, the first thing Marcus said, what do you want now? And I said, well, we want ships to replace the ships. We want enormous productivity. We want weapons and guns, and we need fighting men. So a million men were sent over, and an incredible amount of armaments. And it's the first mobile war. And the great trucks are moving and so forth. And the first war where you have tanks, enormous mobile equipment. And the productivity was organized here in America was just incredible. I told you about that before, where the amount of energy that was used was so great, and copper was the handmaiden of the energy, that we produced more, took out the ground and put to work more copper in 1 year than had been mined and refined, put to work the whole history of man before in one country. So that the productivity that was there when the war was over, I think I mentioned this to you sometimes, that you had productivity, and the copper did not go back into the mines, and it stayed right where it was, and the waterfall kept going, and the waterfall kept falling, and the wheels kept going around, so that they began to use this productive capability in peace times, and the banks didn't like the idea of automobiles, but the kids and young people like myself did, and we wanted them, so the financing of automobiles was done entirely by considered quite shyster people who loaned us money at considerable interest rates, but we were able to get our cars. Banks don't go into loaning money for automobiles till after World War II. The Ford Motor Company got in, they got and the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, they realized in order to be able to sell their cars, they had to somehow accommodate the time buying. But banks did not look on it with favor. But the banks did look on with favor, because the banks didn't want chattel mortgages and going around and repairing the car that didn't feel it had enough equity in there. Banks liked, however, use of the machinery productive to make the farm machinery. And the farm machinery then, I did not go this with you before, did I? The farm machinery was beautiful for the moment. And did just what you wanted, but you could only use it once a year for 2 or 3 weeks. So it sat there, it had to be taken care of. The banks loved that because the banks not only had a mortgage on the machinery, but they got a mortgage on the farm. And there's something tied up with that farm. You could really hold on to it. So the equity was very much higher. And I want you to remember what the banks are doing. They are loaning money. Nobody knew until I said there's wealth and something. Nobody knew. Seemingly they're loaning their money, and they're entitled to it. Anyway, with the bad hog market of 1926, things began to go wrong on the farms, and they couldn't meet their payments on the machinery. And farm after farm was seized, mortgages were foreclosed. And the only people who could buy it was the farmer, and the farmer lost their money. So the farmers were being put out of business and couldn't get them back, and so the farms began then to be unsaleable in part of the banks. And they found they didn't have any bathrooms, they didn't have anything. Then nobody wants them to just a place to go and live. And things began to deteriorate, and the plowed fields went wrong, and dust bowls began. And in no time at all, then the bigger banks began to foreclose on the little banks because they didn't pay their interest. So gradually it got to where the bigger banks still, the bigger cities, were foreclosing on the smaller banks. And what happened, the people, they put their deposits in there, and they'd been all the time depositing with the banks because these are very incredible wealthy people, and our money will be absolutely safe for them. Their wealth is something inexhaustible. So you can get, they're doing great favors there if you put, but the thought of the bank was designed architecturally, has a great vault and everything, it's absolutely safeguard there, and big stone walls, your money is safely in that bank. The fact is that what the banks are doing, they're simply taking everybody's deposit and meaning loaning it out to make money with. Went right in one door and out the other, and making money for the banker. Wasn't his money, but he got into all kinds of ventures. So suddenly, when people wanted to go and get their deposits out, and the banks had been foreclosing on all the farm, nobody wanted a piece of a farm, they couldn't cash the check, so the banks began to have enormous runs. So this, the great crash begins in this way, and then pretty soon got to the biggest banks. This is then your great crash in 1929 is because back in the back scenes this is going on, and the people in the know that the capital system is in some real shaky condition. We have finally all the Western banks, Chicago banks got closed. I was living in Chicago at that time, and so no more, all that deposits are gone. And we have then the New York banks are about to close. At the point where 5,000 banks are closing a day. Now, the Franklin Roosevelt was elected, and the Congress accelerated his inauguration by a month. And no sooner had he been sworn in than he turned around and signed the bank moratorium, as the last banks in New York had not actually been closed, but they were absolutely all through. And this, he called a bank moratorium, and let's look this thing over. So then, what happened then? The Congress then said, we the people. They looked at the banks, and what they found was, this is the first time in history, man, that wealth, historical wealth, had to open its hands, because the thing was a mess, and the government had to move in to see what is in there. Found the banks didn't have anything. They never had anything. Absolute blow. They'd had this king's claim to the land, but really wasn't negotiable. But on the strength of its reputation, so well, they've got all these all the working money of people put in their bank, and been all been and that's no substance. So, if you go back in the records of time, I was by this time, 1932, I was 37 of years of age, so I very very much in the awareness of the times. We have, if you go back, then the president of the National City Bank in New York went to Sing Sing, and the chief partner, J.P. Morgan, went to Sing Sing, and the president of the Chase Bank went to Sing Sing. They not only had been doing things they had absolutely no right to do, but they'd been even more immoral. They were selling their own best friends short. They were bucket shopping their laws. They were bringing every kind of immoral thing being done. So that finding that they were doing all kinds of things that the funds they had no right to do, the government then stopped there and said, now, they had a New Deal government, and they declared themselves to be in the last time of the forgotten man. I said, people apparently, the government could at this point institute any kind of government they wanted. If you wanted to invent a new government, see the better way of doing things. They found that people had very powerful conditioned reflexes, and when they did their work, then they earned paper money relative to the wealth, the life support they were really producing on the farms, which man 90% on farms in those days. So they did not like to keep their money under the mattress. The houses burnt down as the dangerous people came and stole it from them. They preferred the idea of a bank. So the New Deal decided people want banks. Furthermore, it was very much in the vigor of the independence of the American that he didn't like something called socialism. He didn't really know much about what it was, but something he didn't like. It's something where you're going to be tied up some kind of way. You're going to have to stand in line, and it's an unbecoming thing. I'm an independent character. Because he was really out, really battling the wilderness to get that farm going. He really fought terrific battles for his life to do what he did. You can understand how he felt. All right. So the New Deal said they don't want socialism, and they want the money in the bank. So we the people guarantee the banks. Now this is completely different from the landowner. This suddenly really put wealth was in on belonged to people. Therefore, it really was socialized. We the people became the last recourse of the wealth, and not the landowner. In a sense, this is too fancy language for America to digest. But the point was, we did. So we said we guaranteed. The way we did was to guarantee the bank accounts up to amount that was way over what anybody probably would ever have in his bank account. Because he got any over that, he'd be investing someplace else. He wouldn't get up to 5 or 10,000, what it was. Then they found, we took over the banks, and the banks are just all these mortgages. And there were all those farmhouses out of bathroom, and the houses were without roofs, and everything was going to pieces. So we, the people then, with our bank, said, we've got to rehabilitate the mortgages. We've got to make the buildings worth something. So we gave negative interest loans. They actually paid people to borrow money, to put a new roof on and so forth, and we gave them 30 years to pay it back. So it was just no problem at all. They got the buildings fixed up. Now, historically, also something else had gone on here. I gave to you the other day about the know-how business, remember, of the pharaohs and so forth. Well, finally, we had the know-how to take care of everybody's life and get everybody in the next life, but also take care of everybody's living life. I give you that. And where the artist then used to make the one off, and he, you know, so he made the tools that made the end product, rather, and the energy of the inanimate energy began to get on the ends of the levers. So this, we're coming to the era of real inherent mass production, where everybody is a patron instead of just the king or the fancy middle class. And a world that was illiterate, that suddenly had to become literate. And just really, in this century, the increase in literacy is just incredible. It's been gone from something like 90% illiterate to the other way. About 10% that is illiterate. So that it's going out very fast. And humanity is in on the information. Humanity is the patron. So mass production had to be what you had. But again, I told you the building world, where the national defense is always putting all the wealth in, it had to be you or me, into the weaponry. Nobody's ever been looking at the housing side. So the building arts could not be more profoundly behind the times, 1,000 years out of gear with the way you produce an airplane. And so what the government did this time, they took over the housing. They took over the building industry, which had gone absolutely bust itself. It wouldn't work any further. And so they began to try to repair those buildings, and more and more was given to do that. And then so the government, from this time on, the only money available to produce buildings was government money. So we have incredible things that were done here. Now I'd like to go into that more. The government then, realizing that we really were socializing, in fact, but the people didn't like socialism, so we didn't want to call it that. So what they did was to socialize the corporations instead of the people. And they said there are a certain number of prime activities in this industrialization, making steel. You just got to have steel. You can't have industrial. So they were going to socialize U.S. Steel. What they did was then to give these corporations orders, government orders. They didn't give them money directly. They gave them orders, and then because they had a government order, the corporation then had, practically, then a negotiable contract. It was then able to go to the bank and borrow the money to buy the materials and pay the wages, then to sell, deliver the goods to the government and got paid back, and therefore it paid back the bank, and the government then went to the bank and borrowed the money to pay the corporation. It's a very complex thing going on, but we the people, we call ourselves we the people's government, and we the people are doing this and that, we go in and out of our banks two to three different ways. Anyway, we had also then the house cleaned the whole of the banking system, so SEC was set up, and from then on, no banks were allowed to do any, have investment houses. They all had stock and bond brokerage departments in the bank. But no longer do I do that. Those kind of be a separate corporation, not banks. In those days, insurance companies could only buy bonds, in city bonds and government bonds. Now, the government then came in and policed the whole of the of banking to such an extraordinary extent that people who had bank jobs at this time were really just clerks like the post office. But they were allowed to make loans. But obviously, because the government then said, we're going to loan on this house. And the government set up the USHA what the building loan should be. And the government guaranteed it. And then they had the bank loan the money, and they could make money on the exchange. This would then pay for the crookage and then get rigging the bank on. Well, series of things happened. They also then found U.S. Steel, said we can't carry out all of our machinery is obsolete, we're in a mess. The United States at that time gave U.S. Steel something like $18 million worth of new machinery. We set up what they call the United States, Finance Corporation. What is it?
RFC.
Reconstruction Finance Corporation and Reconstruct the Old Economy. Jesse Jones, the head of it, and that got to be the largest corporation in history. And it was actually given billions of dollars of capital. And it began then to, I said, rehabilitate by loans or loan machinery, set up all the second direct corporations, the government machinery loaning corporations, and so forth. And then those corporations. Loans with Fivanti, they would negotiate with the company and let it buy it for a song. But anyway, they got the corporation going. And so this is a very subtle form of socialization, I said, done really just by orders rather than by cash. And then the negotiability of coming back to the banks, we the people guaranteed. And that we would take their loans and nothing got people being hired again and salaries getting to be distributed. There were no jobs at the time. We have in what went on this point on, there was a great deal of trouble of the New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt found the enterprises, people wanted to make money, being very, very adverse. The heads of the big corporations said to Roosevelt, we are not elected by the people. As we are the company are elected by the stockholders. Unless the stockholders are making money, then we're not going to get reelected, and we want to be reelected. We know how to start. Therefore, we can't really cooperate with you because you're speaking to the people, but I'm speaking to my stockholders. Stockholders got to be making some profits. So the government said, all right, we'll do what we can so to make that work better by giving us more orders. Anyway, for the first few years of the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt then said, and all the New Deal government and his advisors said, what is going on? The trouble is that the corporations have been paying off dividends and building up surplus for dividends and not rehabilitating with the right machinery. They've just been milking the cow without really facing the new and getting ready for new. So that the government tried very hard to persuade the corporations that it was their job to do research and development and get the new machinery. But they said, no, we won't spend that money. We've got the surplus here, and we've seen this mess we've been in. We don't want to get caught in that mess. We luckily had some surplus, so we didn't go bust. And up to this time, historically, an enterpriser, then, if he did well with his enterprise, if it was profitable, if he was a wise man, he took his profits and went into research and development, see what ought he to develop next. Just because evolution is at work, and you're going to have something new. You're going to have to meet evolution. So, always, research and development been a part of profit. It was a privilege of your own profit that you would have enough of your profit to pay some dividends, but also to get ready for the new. But the corporation wouldn't do it anymore. So finally, Franklin Roosevelt got the Congress degree and everything that from this point on, research and development could be accounted as part of working costs, production costs, and therefore you could really add to the cost of your goods, the cost of production, and it then came on the customer, not coming out of the profit, the man who was making the profit. This was quite a ruling. It was a hidden subsidy worth incredible amounts. Then the American newspapers said to the New Deal, we can't keep out, you can't have democracy without news. People have to know what's going on in order to know how to react. And we can't keep our newspapers going without advertising. And you don't have any allowance for advertising in here. And so the companies are not advertising, and we're going to go bust, you won't have newspapers. So the Treasury Department at this point ruled that, that from this time on, advertising would be research and development deductible also the basic cost. So this would put in, as the government began to give orders, and this would be part of the cost of that order. In other words, a complete, that amounted to, literally to a $7 billion a year subsidy, which started Madison Avenue. We have then the World War II is really coming on, and Franklin Roosevelt, in order to keep those corporations going, one of the things the government can always do in way of orders, go to your military, what do you need? And so in order to keep the things going, they've been really getting ready for a World War II, making all kinds of, building new navies and so forth. So we have World War II is approaching, and the heads of the big corporations said to the American, to the New Deal government, you know, World War I, there was a lot of dirty talk when it was over about all the profiteers, because there was all this wealth and evidence that, in contradistinction to previous wars, where they used up the farm things, but suddenly there was that machinery and didn't deteriorate when the war was over. It was right there. So there was really wealth there. Fundamental production capabilities, real wealth. So they said these must be war profiteers. There was an enormous amount of feeling about that and that kind of talk. So the heads of the big corporation said, we're coming to World War II. We don't want to be, you know, we're not representing the people. We're representing our stockholders and so forth. They're going to make a profit. And we don't want to be charged with being profiteers of this war and so forth. And we're going to have all that kind of battle. So we can't cooperate. So the New Deal said, all right, you do have to have some profit, and you know, in order to, and we want you as management. You're very good management. Been processed that way. Therefore, what we're going to do is to agree that in the war, you can have profit up to 12% on an order. If you have enough orders of the year, you might make quite a little more than 12%. But 12% is the limit. And then what we're going to do is to renegotiate. We're going to continually have our inspectors make sure you're really earning that, and see whether there's a trick going on here. So this was done. The average after renegotiation was 10%. What happened then was the war order of $70 billion for this year. 10% was marked for the stockholders of the company. So what they did was really socialized stockholders, socialized corporation. They socialized starting with Madison Avenue. Really all the people in propaganda that kept bothering them. The propagandists began to get very busy in the newspaper and everything. Really forced them in all these subsidies. So then we have our world war, but I want to get that but during those, the New Deal setup did have price controls, and it did have absolute limits of, they got to talk about usury and interest rates. So they're holding interest rates of 3% and 3%, something very, very modest down there. And then with World War II over, things really, then suddenly began to go. Enormous monies had been made. There really was the beginning of the buying of campaigns and so forth, and suddenly all price controls went out. I mean, the rental that I was paying $70 for a month from apartment in New York, three-room apartment, kitchen, very, very nice, and the landlord was really getting on fine. And suddenly this allowed it all to go up to $400 and $500 for the thing. Like, everything went backward. So they really let the big money really bought the right to break loose, and then when you get to something like prime rates going up to 10%, well, it doesn't take but 10 years at 10% for you to really take over to the bank account of the depositor. That's exactly what happened. But in the meantime, in the last years and the last decades, we have the big corporations being able to discover something. General Motors and Singer sewing machine made the first discovery. We have something been colonialism. In colonialism, the European nations of power who control the water ocean world they claimed and owned parts of all around the world. There's various claims, And they took the people who were living in a kind of life, the non-industrial life, and the people in Ghana didn't know what aluminum is, what bauxite is. People took this brown dirt away. That's okay. They're not interested in brown dirt. Well, they took away from the countries, took to England and Europe in general, and took out the metals and produced goods and so on, and then they brought it back to the people as goods, as an enormous markup of the materials that really come from them, and of course the people are paying more to get the stuff in than they're getting going out. Therefore, the balance of trade was always against the little guy, and the balance of trade was a complete manipulation. I told you when the great masters of the water ocean world found they'd been carrying gold with them to do their trading, found it'd be hijacked. So the English and the Spanish made that mistake. So now the English went into then just having annual accounting, and this balance of trade came in, and then they just one back to the other in London. So that we find then that colonialism was a taking away, that's the main thing, and a markup going to a relatively few people in the world, a great advantage, and they could control the banking system itself, and every way they turn the accounting to their advantage. We have the Singer sewing machine, and General Motors discovering something very interesting. But it was precipitated by after World War I, when Mexico suddenly said all the oil companies were coming into, because automobiles got going, and the oil companies were coming into Mexico and simply taking over the land, putting up the refineries, and just paying no attention to Mexico as a country at all. And the Mexican government and people just said, we're not going to have this business, and they took over their own refineries and things, said they belonged to us. Up to this time, the big corporations have been able to excite Americans into going protecting their interests. That terrible things the Mexicans are doing, but America was through World War I and it was tired and wasn't interested in what went on there in Mexico at all. So the corporation could not get the Americans to send down the Navy and so forth, which they tried very hard to do. So Mexico got away with it. It was something she should get away with anyway. It's the first real protest to colonialism. And furthermore, Mexico then said, you've been sending all your second-hand automobiles after the taxi cabs get through with it and so forth, then absolutely no good, and we don't want this junk. We would like to have automobiles, but we're not going to let you export anything to us. All this colonialism is a game of exporting a bad balance of trade. General Motors, we would like to have a Buick, we would like to have a Mercedes, we'd like some good cars. But you'll have to come here to Mexico and set up a factory. And you're going to have to give Mexico a large amount of your shares. You come here, but you're going to leave plenty of your shares, so you can only do very well if you come here and do well. If you do well, you do well. If you give us a good deal, you're going to get out. So that you must use Mexican resources wherever they're possible, but if there's something needed in making an automobile that does not occur in Mexico, it's your responsibility to bring it to Mexico. You've got to go around the world, get the stuff. So as long as you keep giving us good satisfaction this way, you keep on making all the money you want here in Mexico. General Motors found this very much better than really the former colonialism, where you had to suddenly decided we didn't need the United States and the army to make it stick. If they were doing a good job, the Mexicans would protect it. This is really opposite of colonialism. So this is where the supranationalism began. So during the post years after World War II, while the big money, there's no question about it, colonialism still in oil, taking away. The big colonialism of oil saw the big oils coming in Southeast Asia, and there was a game of who's going to run the world of Russia and the United States, and whoever is going to have the biggest army and navy's got to have all the oil too. So we had, whether it's been the Vietnam or Viet Cong wars, or Vietnamese didn't have any tanks and rockets and things. This is Russia and the United States every single time playing the game using puppets. They said, if we ever join the war directly as Russia, we cannot break it. But if we do it through the puppets, we can break it. We keep things sort of more or less under control. So we have then back of the colonialism wanting the oil, and particularly backed by government, because the army navy said you're going to have that oil. So the Southeast Asia was important, so not Vietnam, but Vietcong, nothing to do with it. And yet being puppeted in all this mess. This then brought about in really big money finding more and more of the campaigns to be to government to elections so forth, needing enormous amounts of money. Therefore, there's a fundamental corruptibility where the big money could just simply really have its way. So that the big press and keeping everybody looking at Vietnam and Viet Cong, something you don't like at all. But in the meantime, all the 500 largest corporations in America moved out of America. They finished the market in America, they got all they wanted out of it, and they went away. From 1953, the five largest corporations in America, four out of every $5 of new plant investment was going into foreign operations. That's the same proportion they're on. So gradually other biggies finally got to do that too, so that we have America, the big businesses milked America all it's going to get, just a branch office now, and big business is completely out of it. And so looking and being really protected by the rest of the world. I realized something great, but more than that, in order then to build their foreign plants, they needed money. So government then got up foreign aid. And then a codicil to foreign aid that says that if there's an American corporation present in that country, it must be spent with them. So simply they simply financed the building of all these corporations. And the money officers of those big companies said, we really need gold because we're going to do all the new plant, but you really have to be able to go. So the big American corporation really took the gold out of America. After they'd taken it out, then they gave Nixon orders, and he simply cut the gold loose from the dollar. And so that, whereas at $33 an ounce, the $180 an ounce, our buying ability in the world would reduce to, literally took away all but one-sixth of our money. Once you realize that this is the biggest hoist in history, something like $100 billion simply taken away from America. This is quite a dilemma we're in. Now, what is really very important is that the Arabs had the oil, and they realized that these big companies really had to really play with them because they couldn't run the companies without the energy. So the Arabs are really taking they have both what is essential, seemingly, and they also have all the ability to buy it. They have all the gold. So that doesn't really work very well. So they now have the big American banks and so forth that coming in as advisor and how they can make this thing work. So we have the banks selling know-how rather than selling properties. In fact, if all the banks are trying to get out of the properties, they realize properties is what you don't want. As you get it on a world basis, you can't take it into the next world, but you can't take it around the world either. So property is now just what you don't want. So they try to get all Americans to buy all condominiums, to buy everything. People didn't really want to buy the houses anyway. They would like to rent because they knew they're going to move out of the Java town pretty soon to another town. They didn't want to, but they were forced to buy. And now what's really going on is the whole capital was trying to get out from property and get over the know-how game instead of the physical property. Property is becoming onerous. Now, all of this would mean a very great mess, I assure you. And a lot of trouble for us if it weren't for the fact that then that computer has come along. And by virtue of the computer, by virtue of information that the young world is taking on, by virtue of the literacy of humanity, we are going to really come in for an accounting system. And we'll come in for a cosmic accounting system, and we're going to discover that the wealth, the ability to take care of life is just enormous. And it just keeps continually hidden by fantastic wealth going into the armaments game. Russia would like long ago to have been able to stop the armaments race, and they made it really very clear to me they would. But they would not come to any agreement from a weak position. They wait till they get strong. But their people have wanted some of the benefit of this industrial age and didn't have it. So that I see it. Then we really cut the nonsense, the negative side. When we really start looking out for people, something else altogether is happening. And this is possible by virtue of the computer. I've talked really simple and very hard, But these are the real controls have been going on all this time. And I was asked to give the final luncheon banquet talk of the American Academy of Social and Political Sciences last June here in Philadelphia, and all the learned scientists there, but also many of the countries. And Gromyko was the chief speaker in the 3-day program. I gave the final one. I said just what I said to you just now. I was amazed when I got an ovation from all the people present, America's everybody. And after, as I finished my talk, I said quite a little more about this performance business that I've given you. I gave other inputs that I've given you. But at the end, the first Russian secretary was the largest, highest officer they had, their president, that luncheon, stood up and went to the rostrum. I was all through, and the things all over, and he delivered great approbation of the talk that I'd given. And after it's over, the Chinese gave me some. So I feel really quite comfortable. The things I've been saying to you, I'm saying very, very openly. I'm not considered in any way some kind of a political renegade and troublemaker. I really have been apolitical all these days, and I'm really trying to keep score. And the score I'm giving you really is a very accurate one. You really feel quite confident in what I've just said. Thank you.